This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it?
1999.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Liskove. And with me today, returning to talk about magazines, is Tori Brevetti, co-host of the podcast Best of the Americans, the Rewatch podcast, and Emma Fraser, freelance writer focused on costume design, pop culture. She's written for Little White Lies, Vulture, and Elle. We're here to talk about a magazine that I don't know if that many people, like, I feel like generationally, and I feel like Emma and I are closer than Tori, who's a child. Emma, do you remember this magazine existing?
Me?
Yeah, I do.
We didn't have it as much over here. Well, I remember buying it when Lord of the Rings came out. But in terms, like, it wasn't like a Rolling Stone where I had seen it a lot, because Empire was more of a big one.
Still is. Just to sort of give a little bit of context, essentially this magazine started in France. It was a French magazine called Première, started in 76. And then in 1987, they created a UK imprint, or sorry, US imprint of it, which started with Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks on the cover for Dragnet, a movie that kind of doesn't really exist now. And then it ended in its run in April of 2007 with Will Ferrell on the cover. So it ran for, you know, ran for about, you know, 30 years or so, or 20 years. I'm doing my math incorrectly. And it was a big magazine, at least for me being a film nerd in the 90s. It kind of had its heyday in that decade, I would say. And then magazines, by and large, as we all know, have sort of slowly died, unfortunately, but or are dying. So I kind of wanted to do this because it felt like an opportunity to talk specifically about sort of like movie magazines. You know, there was kind of this time when, and I guess we still have it now, but sort of the specificity of magazines that existed in a time when they could like really kind of hone in on a specific thing. And this magazine was just purely about movies. And I thought it was pretty insightful. I'm very curious because we all kind of, as a disclaimer to our listeners, we didn't cover every single issue because quite frankly, we had to buy these issues on eBay. So we didn't buy them all because quite frankly, I don't need to own an issue with Vince Vaughn or Johnny Depp on the cover. but we did kind of get into all of them for the most part. And I found these articles were pretty in-depth on issues of its time that now, in hindsight, are kind of interesting to kind of dive into. It also, you know, I'm obviously interested to hear all your thoughts about the various things that they cover in these issues, but they kind of dig into the technical filmmaking stuff that is really, I found fascinating to talk about now. And I took some pictures from a James Cameron article that I posted on Twitter yesterday in particular. I thought the James Cameron and George Lucas articles in particular were interesting to the world that we live in now. So there's a bunch of stuff that I thought were really fascinating. But what did you guys think about the sort of from 30,000 feet, what did you think about this magazine and sort of these issues?
I thought it felt kind of trade-esque, but it was like, it was weird. It was like an amalgamation of being like a trade magazine. Yeah. And it felt more tradey than say Empire does. Sure. Like it felt more kind of inside baseball. Yeah. I found the profiles interesting. As well, there's a lot of women writers. There's a lot of women like doing the profiles, which I was not expecting.
Pleasantly surprised by that.
So yeah, it was, I just thought it was like an interesting mix of trade reviews. Yeah, it wasn't what I remember, but then I had only bought I think that one issue of like Lord of the Rings.
It definitely felt like it sort of had its finger on the pulse. I can only assume, because again, like I obviously wasn't out here then, so I don't really know. And as we all know, even now, it's all kind of, you know, speculation in a lot of ways. It's just people sort of assuming that they know what's going on. but some of it did feel like there's one article in particular, and I can't remember which issue it's in, talking about star power and all of the like castings that are going, and you're just like bizarro castings that at the time you're just like, really? You were chasing this person for this role? So that stuff was fun. But Tori, what did you think?
To go off that, so many films that were just never made that they mentioned, like were in production.
or weren't released around this time as well. Like, I mean, infamously, I posted an amazing line about Reindeer Games that I will read when we get to that issue. Oh. And just thinking like Reindeer Games didn't even get released in 99. Like they punted that to 2000 because they knew that movie wasn't very good. It's amazing to see sort of, and this is, I guess what's great about this magazine in a lot of ways is the microcosm of this town and how things get kind of blown out of proportion for good and for bad. Sometimes it's to try to make a movie, you know, sell or a career bigger than it is. There are many profiles of many people that I'm just like, this person was never going to be a thing, but you guys really tried to make them a thing. So that kind of stuff I thought was funny.
Yeah. And I found like the photo shoots interesting because they're like pretty bad on the whole. Like the styling is awful. Like it's not like a Vanity Fair. Yeah. It's not like a Vanity Fair shoot where like, you know, it looks like they've just thrown whatever clothes they had nearby. They're like, here, wear this horrible top. Like
even some of the covers, the cover shoots as well.
Miles.
It's really crazy that I mean, the first issue that we'll probably dive into is the February one, and Christina Ricci on the cover is crazy. Like some of these photo shoots. Now, again, I don't even, and you guys will know this better than I will, but just like, is that emblematic of the time, or is that emblematic of this magazine?
I think it's a tiny bit of the time, but mostly of the magazine.
As our Rolling Stone covers, which we talked about in our previous episode together, those magazine covers were sort of, first of all, iconic in their own way, right? Because there's a bunch of those there that have stood the test of time. A different magazine, a much more popular magazine, a different thing. But those magazine covers were just like, I don't know, just amazingly sort of, they really just pop. Whereas a lot of these just feel sort of slapped together.
It looks like catalog shoots. I'm not kidding. Like looking at this is a catalog shoot. This is what you would get. Like,
She just held up the Cruel Intentions cover, but like even this one where it's just like, they just look sad and emaciated and like blown out. This picture, it's the cover of Winona Ryder and Angelina Jolie. Now, admittedly, maybe that's just part of what they're trying to get across with this movie that is its own heady movie in itself. But still, like, yeah, crazy. These shows, even this one too, this Heather Graham one.
Yeah.
Was just bubblicious. And it's just her. Yeah. Kate Winslet just looking super bored. Yeah.
I had that top probably. Like, I should not have the top of a cup of star when I was like 14 or whatever.
They're crazy. Yeah. So yeah, it is interesting that the fashion, it's not a fashion magazine, right? So I think that it's pretty clear that they're not even trying. Is everything okay, Tori? Tori just looks very concerned for a
my
second.
My cat is like going crazy.
That's fine. Good. We can't hear it. It's all good. No worries. let's start from the very first issue of 99 is one with Vince Vaughn. So we didn't buy this issue. We didn't dive into this issue. There are several things on this cover that are problematic, which is why I was just like, we don't need to. Vince Vaughn being perhaps the first one. This is right before Psycho comes out. Or did Psycho come out in 98? I think it came out in 98.
Psycho was 98, yeah.
So it was right. It was December or November of 98. So he's on the cover of January of 99, which I guess, again, they're trying to make him into a dramatic leading man. We all kind of know how that happened or played out. He then becomes sort of pivots back to comedy, becomes obviously much bigger in comedy, and now he's whatever he is. But on top of that, on the cover, we have Mel Gibson's Power Play and John Travolta's Scientology flick. So there's just a bunch of things on this cover. Also, Mighty Joe Young and Thin Red Line is on the cover as well. And Angelina Jolie there's a sort of sub headline on her as well. We didn't talk about this issue. Let's just talk about this cover, I guess. What are our thoughts on Vince Vaughn? Tori, your face seems to speak that you have thoughts, no?
Nothing positive.
Fair point.
Really?
He was, he's a good looking guy. I mean, I do understand why they thought he could perhaps be a leading man. It's a good cover. I don't know.
Also, the Psycho thing's weird, right? Like, I mean, I guess that would have come out like around the time the movie did, but I don't know. Because Psycho is obviously such a like flop. Like, yes. Although I have a funny story about Psycho. So the Please. Only time I've ever Skyped work called in sick, because I worked at McDonald's. I was like 16. Okay. And the guy I was going out with at the time was like, come to Birmingham. We're going to go shopping and see Psycho. Who?
What a date. What a lovely date.
Went and saw, I called in sick for my shift. Like literally the only time I've ever done this. And went to see
ever?
Psycho. And
And you're much more diligent worker than I ever was. Right.
And also, I was like, that was my punishment, though. I think that's why I never did it again, because I was like, I saw Psycho. Sure.
I saw Psycho in the theater as well, for what it's worth. I saw it with friends. I remember seeing it. And I remember that, and Tori, have you seen the Gus Van Sant Psycho?
No.
You're fine.
I did not see it in theaters. I was four, so yes. missed out on that opportunity.
But I remember it was a big thing because, well, first of all, it was a remake of a Stone Cold classic that people are just like, maybe don't fuck with this perfect movie. But it was a shot-for-shot remake. So, like, literally every shot is exactly the same from the original film, except recast and in color.
Why? And with the exception of the masturbation scene as well. He added that little masturbation scene.
A little bit.
So, keep the whole movie, but just, you know, you want to see like Vince masturbating through a
correct wall. And there was like a chopper shot that I guess Hitchcock really wanted to do back in the day but couldn't, so Gus Van Sant did it. It was just the oddest experiment, and it was also like, this is one of the reasons why I really hope that the podcast Blank Check covers Gus Van Sant someday, because it's such a weird blank check. It's like he cashed in all of his chips from Good Will Hunting to make a Psycho, shot for shot Psycho remake. It's a bizarre. It's a very bizarre thing. But to your point, Emma, it was a big movie. It was a flop, but it was a big movie.
Yeah.
So they're just trying to do what they were with Vince Vaughn. So the first issue that we're going to really dive into is the Millennium issue, which has Christina Ricci on the cover, crawling out of a pod. out of what I guess could only be described as some sort of a space pod, dressed in, how would you describe this? You guys will do a better job of describing her outfit than I will.
Very Barbarella 60s, like teeny tiny, like silver hot pants, sheer top. It feels very much like it's trying to be like a 60s B movie for some reason.
Right. But also like, kind of cool, like not you know what I mean, because like there it's not trying to be period, like it's not trying to tip its hat to these things.
Sure,
it thinks it's being cutting edge.
Yes, it's being millennium, it's being Y2K, you know?
I love Y2K fashion, and like this is the way they assumed everything would be.
Yeah, it's great, it's great. It's I mean, oh my God. We are at some point going to do a Y2K episode, because I feel like we just have to like really dive into the paranoia that existed around that time. The completely unfounded paranoia that was, it's just tremendous. But this issue was a really great issue, because it was trying to guess things from 20 years in the future. So it was a fair amount of like predictive stuff. So you had George Lucas and James Cameron in particular talking about the future of filmmaking, the future of distribution, digital filmmaking, all that sort of stuff, special effects. You had 20 stars for the year 2020. So 20 people that they guessed would be stars in 2020, which we'll dive into.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
Not terrible.
Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of them were,
but wouldn't
some of them were gimmies, just, right?
Yeah.
100%. We'll just dive into that right now, because I'm just like, most of these people are pretty obvious, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't tell me that like Ewan McGregor, Kate Winslet, Paul Thomas Anderson, Natalie Portman, Will Smith, Leonardo DiCaprio. These are not people that you're just like, these aren't flyers.
No.
And then Freddie Prinze Jr., which proves to not really be a thing. But the great calls for me were Charlize Theron, who at the time is not really, like, she's sort of bubbling, but isn't really a thing. Because in 99, she has The Astronaut's Wife, which is a crazy bad movie. and then the other person they call is Sarah Polley, which obviously, as anyone who's listened to this podcast knows, I'm an enormous Sarah Polley fan, and they call that out. But wouldn't you say, I mean, you bought this issue, Tori. This was kind of, these were a lot of gimmies.
Norman Reedus, though, sorry to like jump in.
Sure.
Yeah.
Called because of Boondock Saints?
Yeah.
Is that, I think that why was, he's on this list?
I can't remember.
That's the only movie he has in 99. So my assumption is that they're just like, Boondock Saints is going to be huge, which, I mean, they weren't totally wrong, I guess. It's a massive terrible movie, but I mean, yeah. I don't think they could have predicted Walking Dead. Sorry, Tori, what were you saying?
I said Isaiah Washington is a choice.
Also a choice. I mean, Out of Sight to come out at 98.
Yes.
Great movie. There's nothing to unpack. Isaiah Washington is its own episode unto itself. But yeah, it's a choice. So I want to talk about the sort of the two. Well, okay, let's talk about the Christina Ricci piece, because she's on the cover, as I mentioned. They say Christina Ricci, queen of the, what does this say? Of the wild frontier. Okay, sure. And the sub headline of her article is, by the year 2020, she should be just about the coolest 40-year-old movie star in the galaxy. Now, listen, I love Christina Ricci. I don't have anything bad to say about Christina Ricci. She's currently starring in, a friend of mine has a Showtime television series that is going to be coming out hopefully later this year that she's in. Love Christina Ricci. Don't have anything really bad to say about her. I think it's a little bit of an overshoot at this point in her career to say that she's going to be the next big thing. But do you think that that's indicative of, we can get Christina Ricci for this piece, so let's just say that this is going to be the next big star? Or do you think that they were just shooting their shot? Okay.
I think she was like the person of the time, and they were like, well, let's just say this. It sounds great. Sure. And no one will read this in 20 years.
But they were wrong. Yeah, there's three people that are going to dedicate an entire episode of podcasting to this this year. I thought that the article with her, And I guess I'm curious, by and large, because these kind of star pieces that they did all kind of have a similar, I don't want to say vibe, but maybe vibe's the right word, of like, they're kind of odd because they don't paint the people that they're interviewing particularly well.
Yeah.
Can we get to it?
Yeah. The starlet's always like smoking, like that's always like a detail, like probably not eating very much. It's always a slight level of contempt for the person, especially women, I found.
Yes.
And maybe women writing about women sometimes, like there's slightly tangential, but there's like a Kate Hudson Vanity Fair cover from 2000 that I read not that long ago, and I couldn't believe how much the interviewer seemed to hate her.
Like, the one that jumps out at me is the Heather Graham one.
Yeah.
That's the one I was thinking of.
The Heather Graham one, which we'll get to, is wild. It is like, it's like a hatchet piece. It's just like, they're just like, I'm like, why would anybody want to be in this magazine? Like, why would any PR person let their star be in this magazine? It's crazy. It's crazy. This one doesn't feel as brutal, but it definitely has a tinge of looking down their nose at Christina Ricci a little bit.
Yeah.
I'll say this. In 99, she's got two pretty big movies. She's one of many, many people in 200 Cigarettes, and she's very good in 200 Cigarettes. I don't know if... Have you seen 200 Cigarettes, Tori?
No, I haven't.
No, I haven't.
I think you guys would really like it. It's a crazy cast. It's Ben Affleck and Christina Ricci, Gabby Hoffman... it's like a who's who. It's a crazy huge cast that I think you guys would enjoy. And Gabby Hoffman, these girls from, I believe it's Long Island, and they just do these insane Long Island accents. Highly, highly recommend. The much bigger film that Christina Ricci has in 99 is Sleepy Hollow, which we'll get to in an issue later down the road. It's an interesting year for her. She has an interesting kind of moment in her career, but she never fully blows up to be sort of a movie star. It's a weird piece, and we'll get to sort of the Cruel Intentions piece as well. There's a lot of this, like, when you're younger, there's a lot of like patronizing kind of component.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And when you're older, it's tearing you apart for being a sex symbol. So there's that. So the other two pieces, and they're sort of the two bigger pieces, are on James Cameron and George Lucas. We'll start with the George Lucas one. I guess let's talk about them both at the same time, because they kind of both hit on something that I wanted to talk about with you guys, which is, I don't really know what the best way to kind of describe this, but I guess it's sort of ego, but also wanting so desperately to be the tip of the spear, technologically speaking, that you don't think about the fallout of the things that you're doing. So, like, I think about what George Lucas and James Cameron, from a digital frontier perspective, have done to kill the mid-budget, smaller, independent movie. And I would also argue possibly the theatrical experience as a whole. And it's sort of hard to not be like, it's impressive what you guys have done. I don't mean to take anything away from how impressive their abilities are, but I wonder if they're cognizant of the bigger picture. And I'm curious as to sort of what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, I also think that George Lucas doesn't seem to understand what people like about Star Wars.
No.
Obviously, this is pre-Phantom Menace coming out as well. So I guess people are like, oh, what's he going to do? And then, like, if you just think about something like Baby Yoda, for example, and he's going on about all the things he can create with digital and how wonderful it is. And then you look at where we are now. And if Baby Yoda was a CGI thing, I don't think anyone would give a shit. Like, people would just be like, meh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good point, Emma. It does feel as though, and this is sort of by and large, the lack of the tactile, you can sense it. You know what I mean? When you're watching something and it's moving in a way, uncanny valley, you know, right? This picture of James Cameron, can we talk about this for a second? he is standing in front
he's
of
feeling himself.
He's definitely feeling himself. He's standing in front of, like, it looks like a star field, like sort of in front of the space, wearing an all black outfit. It's like a trench coat sort of situation. It looks like a black long trench coat. Describe this hat for me, Emma. What would you say this hat is?
Oh, I don't have the picture.
I'm sorry. Okay. It's all good. I'll send it to you. I have all the
I probably have it on my email.
It's all good. It's okay. Apologies to our listeners. It's sort of like a pirate hat almost. It's like this, it's like a turned up. Do you know what I'm talking about, Tori? I believe it's from your issue.
Yeah, I got it. Don't worry.
Okay, cool.
There you go. She's holding it up now.
it kind of looks like a bowler hat.
Yeah. Why?
It's like a little bit, but it's turned up at the sides, top hatty. Yeah, there we go. It's he's feeling himself. Is to put it in the parlance of our times. I think that I'm curious about. So 97 Titanic comes out. It's been 2 years since Titanic. He has not followed it up. He won't follow it up until 2006. Is that when Avatar is? 2006, 2007.
Yeah, right, it's around then.
Might be even later. I think it's 09. My apologies, it's 09.
Was that his next film?
He does a bunch of IMAX fucking things. Oh, right. And he does things that just no one really, he does a bunch of documentaries. But yeah, because Avatar was and continues to be obviously this state-of-the-art thing, he was determined to make sure that he didn't do anything until it was what he wanted it to be. So he spends a decade essentially figuring out what his follow-up will be. It's interesting to hear him talk about the lessons that were learned from Titanic. And by that, I mean length. People thinking that a long movie equals a good movie when pacing is really the thing. There's also a lot of people that try to sort of do big Hollywood sweeping old school epic things. But I mean, I guess I think the most kind of glaring example of this is Pearl Harbor. That feels like the movie that really tries to kind of retcon a bunch of Titanic-y things, a love triangle, a historical moment. It's fucking long. It's expensive. It's all these things. There's a big boat, lots of boats that sink. Like, I think that they just thought we've got movie stars. We're going to make movie stars out of Kate Beckinsale and Josh Hartnett. And so I do wonder whether or not there was just a lot of bad lessons learned from Titanic. But I do think he kind of hits the nail on the head about a couple of them. He's surprisingly prescient about the whole theatrical experience, about what he's bringing to the table, why IMAX is the future. All that stuff's interesting. But I guess I want to sort of hone in on one specific part of this. And I know that, we're still in the midst of a pandemic that has had obviously an enormous impact on the theatrical experience. So it's a little hard to be like, I don't want to be too critical of what he's saying necessarily, but he does talk a lot about fucking raise ticket prices. Do what you got to do in order to allow us to keep making these exorbitantly expensive movies. And I don't care if movies become like theater and people only go to see a couple movies a year. I think that's pretty stupid, but I'm curious as to what you guys think.
Yeah, no, it's very narrow-minded as well.
It's a fascinating sort of thing. It's just interesting that he's so kind of cavalier about the theatrical experience, thinking as though it's bulletproof. And I think we've obviously become abundantly clear that it's not. Streaming is having an effect. Yes, Emma?
I was going to say, also, like, one thing I was like, oh, that's actually quite smart and quite, like, prescient as well about stuff that's going on right now with that Anthony Bourdain documentary is when he's talking about CGI-ing dead people and how soulless it is. And it's like, you are very right. We have seen this.
Keep doing it. Yeah. He does coin a term which I really think we should bring back, synthespians. Can we make that happen?
I think we should.
Because, we'll I mean, I guess. Yeah, right? I mean, Andy Serkis is the ultimate synthespian, I would say. I mean, I absolutely agree with you, Emma, that we've seen a couple instances of it, specifically, it seems, within the Star Wars universe, of younger versions of people or quite frankly, people that aren't with us anymore. It's upsetting. It's strange.
Yeah. I think younger, if they're still alive and they're there, it's less weird because at least they're probably acting. Sure. They've just got dots on their face. I mean, it's probably weird for the actor.
It still looks a little weird, but
yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's interesting because like Rogue One, you have the Carrie Fisher thing at the very end of Rogue One, right? And she was alive when Rogue One came out and it still looked weird, but I was kind of like, okay, we're getting closer. We will get to a place where we won't be able to tell, and that's going to be very unsettling. Mm. But for the time, but it was just sort of like, this isn't terrible. And then there was Mandalorian, the younger Luke, which was just like, what are we doing? Like, this is fucking
I'd actually
crazy.
Forgotten about that.
We're just like, what is happening? So I don't know. I don't want. You know, Humphrey Bogart back in some sort of weird synthespian form. No. I just don't. But maybe
he was in Space Jam too, wasn't he?
Probably. Who isn't?
And also, he's in an ad. I'm sure there's like a Stellar ad with Humphrey Bogart.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. And Audrey Hepburn did Galaxy Chocolate.
Of course. Her best role.
Are they going to have to put it in their will now or their estate? Like, you can't use my
image.
Yeah.
it's really crazy. So then also in this article, there's two other articles in this issue. There's a Digital Revolution one, which I thought was interesting, but gets super technical. But it really kind of gets into the the tall grass, if you will, about special effects. It was interesting insofar as that there's just so many wizards of special effects that will never get their due, and are pushing this technology forward in ways that we'll never even really know. The technological stuff that I'm most impressed with is really the camera movement stuff. It's the stuff that you don't notice. It's the things that allow us to be just sort of seamlessly pulled into the film, as opposed to the digital recreations of a person or some crazy, you know, explosion. I love that Henry Selick and Monkey Bone get a spotlight in this article, a movie that notoriously was incredibly difficult and most people really don't like. Have you seen Monkey Bone? Have either of you seen Monkey Bone? Brendan Fraser. It's kind of a Who Framed Roger Rabbit situation of him being brought into a fictional universe. It's crazy. Like, it's completely bug nuts. I wonder if Monkey Bone will get a reevaluation. Like, that's the type of movie I could see Twitter one day just pulling out of obscurity and being like, Monkey Bone, and then everyone's talking about it for 24 hours. And then there's an article about futuristic dreams in movies. Why are futuristic movies so bleak and dystopian? We just did an episode of our 89 Patreon on Back to the Future Part 2 that we did with Emily Vanderwerf. And it was really interesting to talk about that film through the lens of 2021, especially post-Trump. But it was also just interesting to sort of talk about that 2015 chunk at the beginning of the film. Obviously, it's laughable that it was 2015. But that idea of a future that's a lot more sort of candy-colored, a lot more kind of accessible, a lot more filled with potential, kind of surprised we don't see more of those, but I don't know. It's kind of a bummer.
Yeah. No people, bleak. No.
It's all black and dark. It's all sad. So speaking of sad and weird, the next issue is the March issue with Nicolas Cage and Joel Schumacher on the cover. Well, it's Nicolas Cage, just not Joel Schumacher, but he is focused in this this mm-hmm. article. It's an Oscar exclusive where it talks all about the previous year's Oscars. There's a Cate Blanchett profile. There's a Clint Eastwood profile, and there's directors talking about their first films.
I would say the star of this piece, mm-hmm. Babe, Pig in the City.
Damn fucking right. Babe, Pig in the City is a masterpiece, and we all need to bow at the altar of Babe, Pig in the City. Apparently the movie that almost ruined a studio, if you believe this article. If it's to be believed. I love that article so fucking much.
It was so good.
Let's talk about that article first. It's called Air Under Pressure. It's all about the Bronfmans and the people that are running Universal at the time. And Universal, which I don't think I realized how in the shitter they were in 98, like how bad things were at Universal. I mean, it was one kind of tank after another. Their movies weren't working. and they really just hone in on Babe, Pig in the City. and really kind of just, it's a punching bag in this article. I will say this. I think Babe, Pig in the City is a triumph. I think it's a masterpiece. I really do. Have you seen it?
I have, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have any, strong feelings on it, but you know,
no, I don't
it's not
either.
Terrible. It's not the worst.
Well, you know what? I have strong feelings, guys, if that's not clear. I think that Babe, Pig in the City is a stone cold masterpiece. That being
you have
said,
to rewatch.
You really should. Especially okay. post Mad Max Fury Road, because it feels like everyone kind of reevaluated George Miller's movies after that and okay. sort of were like, wait a second, is this, there was just a lot of kind of, mm-hmm. I will say this, it should not have been made. I think it's crazy that it was made. I really do believe that it is just absolutely crazy. When you read, I posted a slight clip from it on Twitter in terms of the things that had to be done to get it corralled, in terms of them hoping that an edit could help them. But like Mickey Rooney's arc was kind of trimmed. There's a drowning dog sequence that they had to trim. There was just a lot of stuff that they did where they hoped that they could find the movie a little bit. Or hopefully make a movie that was more marketable. Here's the thing. Babe 1 was a big hit, right?
Actually, I've only seen Babe 1. I realize I haven't seen Babe, Pig in the City. I was just looking. I was like, no, I haven't seen
that. Wait a second. Drowning dog. Mickey Rooney. So Babe 2 is about Babe going to the city. and he is sort of, he becomes friends with a bunch of, essentially there's this woman that is, this isn't going to be an episode of a Babe, Pig in the City, but basically there's this woman that tries to save all of these various stray dogs, okay? So Babe becomes kind of the hero of this house filled with all of these stray animals. Tori's face is amazing right now. But the movie's super dark and super existential. And essentially, Babe saves this pit bull that is like this angry dog that's trying to kill all these other dogs, and saves this dog and becomes sort of the patron saint of... It's just a very dark movie is really kind of what I'm getting
at. It looks that.
And it's crazy that Universal was like, yeah, go make this movie. And then was like, oh, wait a second. Why is this movie so fucking weird and dark, and how do we market this movie? And it destroys the franchise. They spent $100 million. They let George Miller direct the film because he kind of pseudo-directed the first one because he produced the first one. And it's just insane. It's insane. It's wonderful. And it's not a surprise that this movie was a disaster. To say that this entire studio hinged on the success of Babe, Pig in the City is insane. And that's what this article essentially presupposes, is like, if Babe 2 was a hit, we'd be running the town. And I just don't think that that's really fair.
They seem annoyed at, well, not annoyed, they seem to blame Meet Joe Black a lot as well. That also
well,
seems
fair.
To, yeah.
So another movie that's insane is Meet Joe Black, which comes out in 98. It's over 3 hours long, which is I mean, have you guys seen Meet Joe Black? Have both of you seen
Meet I've seen
Black?
Bits, but I've definitely seen the really bad sex scene with the really slow undressing. Yes, no wonder that movie is 3 hours. Obviously, I've seen the car, which gets brought up in a later
it's the
piece.
Fucking best. It does get brought up in the Fight Club piece. It is... So Meet Joe Black is a remake of a film called Death Takes a Holiday, which I have not seen, which is the idea that death, the idea of death, I'm putting this in quotation marks, takes over the body of a young man to learn what life is like, is sort of what it's about. And Meet Joe Black is a similar premise. Brad Pitt meets Claire Forlani in a coffee shop at the top of the film. And then is laughably hit by a car. I mean, I'm sure you guys have seen the memes or the GIF that has sort of floated around, but it's full on. He turns basically into Jar Jar Binks. Like, it's this like crazy CG moment when he's flopping around and getting hit by like three different cars. Like, it's just, it's crazy. It's laughable. The movie's 3 hours long. What were they thinking? Like, it's insane. That being said, Meyer starts to take over Universal. His name is Meyer, right? I can't remember his first name in the article. Doesn't matter. anyway, he starts to take over Universal at the end of 98, top of 99. And they do start to have, they have some hits in 99. They've got Notting Hill, The Mummy, American Pie, Bowfinger. They start to kind of get their sea legs and Universal's doing just fine. I'm not worried about Universal. But it is interesting. They've got Mystery Men. They've got End of Days. They've got Man on the Moon. They got a lot of movies that don't hit as well. But it's a fascinating article. In terms of the PR of it, like if I'm working at Universal, I don't want this piece out there in the world. Like it's amazing to me that this magazine wasn't shuttered many times over. Like that people weren't just like, can you stop shitting all over this town? Like, so yeah. it's kind of amazing in that regard. The Nicolas Cage, Joel Schumacher piece.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen 8mm?
No,
I'm not.
It sounds intense. Yeah.
8mm is a lot. The thing that jumped out at me in this article, for obvious reasons, is the Lenny Bruce quote. For Tori, I imagine that was just a real moment. The quote is, no one's ever held up a bank with a dildo, which is a great quote and is a great sort of distillation of why are we so afraid of sex, but we're okay with guns. Mm-hmm. It's odd that it's in this article. Like, I don't quite think this article... I mean, do you guys sort of know what I'm getting at? Like, this article seems to be about violence and sex.
Yeah. Yeah, like, and well, because the Larry Flint stuff, I'm like, why are they bringing Larry Flint into this? Like, so they interview him as well. I'm like, that's it. It takes the wild ride, this article, and like, because Joel Schumacher is like a gift in any interview because he will just say whatever, which just amazing. Like, there's so many
sexually active by 11. I was like, okay.
He said it. There's a Vulture piece that he did before his death where he talked about how he's had sex with thousands and thousands of men. Like, he doesn't even have no idea how many he's had sex with. It's just like amazing. It's incredible. It's a gift. I would also say Nicolas Cage is a gift to anyone who's interviewing as well. Like, this bringing these two people together is a gift.
It also had one of my favorite things. Which in TV, when anyone talks about standards and practices, it's like literally all I want to hear about. But they talk about the thrusting and how
eight
NC-17. And they had that in The Good Wife. There was too many thrusts in the scene. And honestly, it's just like, when is a thrust too much?
That's the question.
When do you turn it off?
it's amazing to me that I mean, listen, we could talk about the MPAA all day long and what sort of arbitrary things they decide are okay and what aren't okay. They talk about it in the Scorsese Spike Lee piece as well, where Scorsese is like, yeah, I mean, I got an R rating for After Hours because of sensuality throughout, which, and you're like, what does that even mean? It's baffling. It's an interesting article. Makes me miss Joel Schumacher. Nicolas Cage and him kind of, they do another film together later with like a straight to video movie that they did with Nicole Kidman called Trespass, I think, which I've never seen. But yeah, 8mm is a weird movie. I kind of like some stuff in it, though. It's got some good stuff, but it's weird. And obviously, you know, Hollywood shouldn't be making films about snuff films. You know, like, let's just not do that. Anyway. So then we have this piece on the Oscars, which was interesting. I guess here's my question to you guys about award shows, because this article made me think about where we're at with award shows in general. Because I feel like the pandemic obviously made us reevaluate award shows and how they work and whether we need them to some degree or another. But it also kind of, because I think about the hoopla around the Oscars this past year that Soderbergh produced, things that were outside of their control, like, for instance, the last award. There was things that just were, that went sideways. I didn't actually take issue so much with the way it felt necessarily. I mean, some of it, the bits didn't work, but like making it smaller, making it a little bit more intimate, making it feel a little bit more special, I don't think is a bad thing. And this piece just made me think about the bombacity and the size of these award shows, the amount of money that's put into them, how much all these sort of moving pieces, and just thinking like, we're doing this to pat people on the back? Like, it's very odd.
I mean, I do love an award show, to be honest. Sorry.
I don't hate them either. I don't mean to suggest that we don't, sure, that there isn't something great about them, right? Like, but I think a red carpet's great, but...
Do you know what this one made me... Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, always there. That's what my main takeaway from this piece was. I was like, oh, all right, this is like...
It's like Moonlight all over again. Moonlight and La La Land all over again.
Yeah.
I don't mean to suggest that we don't need award shows, or that I don't enjoy them, and that there isn't a level of enjoyment in the sort of the spectacle of them.
Sure.
I guess I'm just sort of feeling like, and it certainly feels this way about audiences when you look at the ratings that are slowly declining, that it does feel like less and less people are interested in watching the show than they are seeing the clips that circulate on various social media the next day. And then commenting on that and feeling as though they're part of the zeitgeist through that. That's a problem, I would say, for award shows.
Yeah, no, I agree. But
there's now a Cate Blanchett piece, and God bless Cate Blanchett. She comes across actually better than most people do in these pieces, because she kind of gives zero fucks about the whole thing, even at this stage in her career. But it is crazy to think about the three films she followed up Elizabeth with. Pushing Tin and An Ideal Husband are odd movies to follow up Elizabeth with. Talented Miss Ripley, not so much, even though her role is smaller in that film. She just seems very kind of, even at this time in her, I don't mean to say even, but like at this time in her career, very sort of sure of herself. Very just like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and it's going to play out the way it's going to play out.
Yeah.
Which I kind of respected.
I enjoyed the ghost story. it opens with a ghost story. I enjoyed that. Also, there's a thing, so I'm going to say alleged for a lot of this, but like there's a lot of people in these magazines where you're like, oh, this is an alleged sexual predator. And obviously there is the Jeffrey Rush stuff in this where he's playing an alleged sexual predator. So it was a bit like, oh, like it just feels weird going back and being like, because Harvey obviously has mentioned so much, because it's just every time Harvey's mentioned, it's just like, I mean, he's not alleged, he's convicted, so
Correct.
We can say convicted. Yeah. So yeah, it's just weird how, and it's Scott Rudin, the fact that obviously there's been all that stuff recently about his like behavior, yep. alleged behavior.
He comes up in the, is it Adam's Family, talking about in the Christina Ricci piece, or there's something
he comes up. Spike Lee mentioned him?
Yes, you're right. Scorsese, he bring, because Bringing Out the Dead was produced by Scott Rudin. Yes. That was 99. Yeah, there's, it is, it's hard not, it's, I mean, we've read like 10 issues or 8 issues of this magazine. So and when you see it kind of condensed into that form, it's hard not to feel how prevalent, like how much they were in this industry. Like it was just all over it. Yeah, it's pretty upsetting. There, this Like a Virgin article was cute, which is about these various filmmakers talking about their first films. The one that jumped out at me was Wes Anderson talking about 85 people walking out of Bottle Rocket and then his girlfriend broke up with him. I'm just like, that's just amazing. I'm just like, that's just great.
The so most Wes awesome. Anderson.
The most Wes Anderson thing. So the April issue has Cruel Intentions on the cover. This issue, Emma bought, just a despondent cover. Just three of them just looking just grumpy as fuck.
I would with these bangs, definitely. With
We will post all of these covers on our Twitter feed. So, and you can Google them; they're all out there. But to describe, would you describe this cover for us, Emma?
Well, yeah, it's the three stars. So Sarah Michelle Gellar, Ryan Felipe, and Reese Witherspoon just looking very moody in front of a nice wallpaper. Wearing
very pink, very blonde and pink
outfits. Yeah. That is the...
it doesn't do any of them any favors.
No. I think Reese might be pregnant. I don't know. I think
she's pregnant in a later article.
Yes.
Another issue.
So I think she might be pregnant. So I guess that's maybe why they've given her some...
That article, the thing that really made me sad about the article was just them describing how in love they are. Like Ryan and Reese talking about meeting and falling in love and how just like over the moon they are with each other. I'm just like, oh boy.
Yeah. Speaking of alleged people as well, there's the line where Sarah Michelle Gellar is really upset because Joss Whedon referred to the movie as porny at TCA. And I the fact that it feels like the snowman, the clues were there all along, you know, if we tied it together.
The classic film, The Snowman. Yeah, no, I agree with you. What I thought was interesting about this article was how it was structured. Like it was broken up into the individual people rather than like blending the three of them together, which I guess was just a choice. I thought it was effective at actually painting the three of them. Like I did feel as though it did a good job of not it's not handled with kid gloves. But I did feel as though like I got a sense of who they were, at least perhaps at this moment in their lives, which I thought was relatively interesting. Just because, you know, two of them are going to become, one of them is already a gigantic TV star. But Reese obviously is, you know, what Reese Witherspoon is now. And I appreciate that Ryan Felipe is the one with the smallest career of the three of them. That's kind of, that the man is, I think, is interesting. But I thought that the Sarah Michelle Gellar part was interesting because of how, I don't know that she would be allowed, and I put that in quotation marks, to make Cruel Intentions while being on a WB show now. Like, I don't know that there aren't sort of contractual things about what content you can do, how you can do it, when you can do it on television shows, or at least... It's just, I guess I'm basically getting at that I sort of understand Warner Brothers perhaps being like, this could tarnish the image of Sarah Michelle Gellar and in turn hurt Buffy, which is why I think a little bit of why Joss Whedon's taking a dig at it too, which is he's kind of trying to take the piss out of it so that people don't, you know, so it doesn't hurt his show, which is fucked up in its own way too. But I thought it was interesting. It was interesting to hear sort of that part of it. Yes, Trey?
I was just going to say the Sarah Michelle Gellar pull quote. It's just like, she said, she thought of kissing girl, she was going to throw up.
That
just
is
the way the that's pull like quote. Bolded yeah. in the middle of the article.
Correct. Yeah, they really just like really make it. Yeah, it's, I do think it's interesting. And then there's the interviewer saying something along the line, or someone saying to her that scene would be the masturbatory scene of the year or something like that. Just
I think it's her thing about it, actually, which surprised me. Yeah,
it's weird. It is interesting sort of how much they underline that moment in the film. Oh, and I
she's
get it.
Quoting a review. That's what she's
oh.
doing.
Gross.
It's gross. But it's also like, I remember, and it's unfortunate, but it was a big deal. Like that two young women were kissing was a big deal. It's stupid.
The
all of it. You know, it was just a very big thing. And I guess in the end, I respect that Sarah Michelle Gellar was just like, I'm a professional, fuck it, I'm doing this. Like, let's just do this. But she does blow it out of proportion. It makes it seem as though it's like some
gigantic like two paragraphs deal. In this article about how stressed she was.
it's just like, come on, get over yourself. So I do feel like that's a little bit much. But it's a good article. I mean, I would say too, you know, the movie obviously was a hit. It was a lightning rod. What are your thoughts on Cruel Intentions? Yeah, go ahead.
Can I just talk about the article quickly first? The opening about the director wanting to kill these Valley girls, it's like, that's such a weird opening. Also, I didn't even realize who this guy was. I had to like Google him.
Roger Cumble.
He's still working, but...
We had him as a guest on our Cruel Intentions episode. He was cool. Lovely.
Paint him as very
No, it doesn't. I think that it's so funny because like these issues also kind of, I mean, part of the hatchet jobs that do seem to exist within all of this is I guess they wanted to be a magazine that got people talking, right? So yeah. It's about sort of, you know, poking bears and getting people whatever. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't do Roger Cumble any favors to open this article. Same with the Mike Newell article on Pushing Tin, which we'll get to later as well, where he's painted kind of stupid and painted in a way that doesn't make him look very good. I mean, at one point he screams, "Make it like life." I'm like, oh my God, that is the worst direction I've ever heard in my life. Like, anyway, so yeah.
Oh, but in terms of the movie, yeah. I fucking love it. Like, I still listen to the soundtrack. This was great like, soundtrack. I love Buffy. I love Dawson's Creek. So, like, obviously, mm-hmm. Joshua Jackson shows up. This movie was made in a lab for a 16-year-old me and also a 38-year-old me.
And I feel like people still love it now. Like, yes. People discover it now, teenagers.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. So around the time that we covered it, we had Tom Meissen on to talk about it. I had some friends watch it around that time as well to sort of get their thoughts. It's kind of, I'm so conflicted about this movie because I think there's a lot of great stuff in it. And I don't mean to suggest that there isn't. And I do think that the movie is very tongue in cheek. Like, I think the whole thing is taking the piss out of all these characters. It's all meant to be sort of super over the top. Like, that's the point. But then there is stuff in there that is pretty gross. Like the Ryan Felipe character is pretty gross in terms of how he manipulates Selma Blair. The things that he does to her is not okay. That are deeply problematic in today's world. But I understand that back then it was all kind of done with a sort of a wink and a nod. So you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt. And if you can do that, I think the movie is kind of brilliant. But I think there are people that maybe can't.
I think maybe I have my, rose tinted glasses from seeing it. Like,
for sure.
In the cinema when I was 16, just being like, this is the fucking best. Like, Christine Baranski's in it. Like,
it's everyone's in it and it's great. I remember, and I think I might have said this on the episode, it's so strange. I went to see it with a friend and thought it was great. And I was like, this movie's really funny and it's really cool, whatever. And then one of my best friends, went on a date with a girl, like one of their first dates, to go see it. And I kind of forced myself onto this date because I really wanted to see the film again.
Oh, no.
Yeah, super fucking weird. And then I'm sitting there halfway through the film and thinking, oh my God, I so desperately don't want to be here on this date while they're watching this film. Like, it was just so awful. But whatever, I was 19 and it was what it was. So then we have this Ron Howard piece, which I thought was interesting.
Bryce is a great casting agent, is what I will say. That my main takeaway from this piece, Bryce Dallas Howard. Like,
great casting, great casting.
Yeah. Yeah,
she's great. I think EdTV is underrated. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it's a great comedy. I think you guys would really like it, especially in sort of the reality television world that we live in now. It's a really fun movie. And I know that it kind of got overshadowed by The Truman Show because they both have similar concepts, and it just kind of just didn't hit the way that it should have. But I think EdTV is great. Kind of insane that he almost didn't make Apollo 13, which is inarguably his best film, I would say.
Yeah.
The only film that I like.
Wow. Really? Parenthood's great.
Yeah.
Silence. Crickets from Tori.
I haven't seen Parenthood, so I can't.
Parenthood's great. I actually really like the... first of all, I agree with you, Tori. It is his best film because it's like... it's a movie with a capital M, and it's like, mm-hmm. it's everything that you want from Ron Howard, like just killing it. Tom Hanks, everyone's just killing it. I like his smaller comedies too, because I think he actually does do camaraderie really well. I think EdTV is great. I think The Paper's great. I think some of his lesser kind of successful films are actually some of his best films. So
I like Happy Days.
Sure. I like American Graffiti. I do think his lack of hubris on Far and Away is kind of amazing. Because that movie is bad. That movie is bad. It's crazy. Yeah. So there you go. Then there's a piece on Oscars 98. And I wanted to talk with you guys about the nominees. I pulled up the thing here. Bear with me a moment as I just sort of like 98 Best Picture nominees were Elizabeth, Life is Beautiful, Saving Private Ryan, Shakespeare in Love, The Thin Red Line. Notoriously, Shakespeare in Love one, beating Saving Private Ryan, which is a pretty crazy thing. That's sort of, I guess, the jewel in Harvey Weinstein's evil crown. I think hindsight being what it is, I think everyone probably thinks that Saving Private Ryan should have won. I also, speaking of Shakespeare in Love, the Kate Winslet piece and her talking about turning down Shakespeare in Love is a crazy sort of sliding doors moment. I think she would have been great. I think she would have had, you know, a real British accent, which, you know, and not a bad British accent that she won an Academy Award for. I mean, insane. Is the movie as big a hit if Kate Winslet is playing the lead? I don't know. You know, Gwyneth at that time was sort of like, there was this kind of cresting moment for her. So it does feel sort of like that movie is riding her wave a little bit. But I would love to have seen the Kate Winslet Shakespeare in Love movie. That's one that I really would have been interested in seeing. It's not to say that Gwyneth is bad or that the movie's bad. I think Shakespeare in Love is a lovely movie. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I just don't think it's a great movie. Mm. But anywho, I guess I don't want to go through all the nominees because it's not actually one of like the better Academy Award years in terms of like the nominees. It's just sort of like it's you know, you've got Judi Dench winning for Shakespeare in Love, and she's in the film for I think it's 11 minutes total.
It's something insane.
Yeah, she's not in it for very long. You obviously have Gwyneth wins over Cate Blanchett for Elizabeth, which is crazy. It's a choice. It's a weird year. James Coburn winning for Affliction. It's just kind of, it's just not the best year.
It's also extremely white. It's very, very white. Yeah. Also, I will point out, Babe Pig in the City did get an original song nomination.
Yeah, oh, I saw that. It didn't get anything else. It should have been nominated for, you know, special effects, for instance. But you know what? Listen, this is not a Babe Pig in the City
episode. Best picture? I don't know.
You mock.
Lead actor, Babe the Pig.
You know, it's funny you say that. Very, very brief, very funny story. Went to see Babe Pig in the City in the theater with two of my best friends. And one of my good friends, Kaylee Tessier, said as we left the theater that Thelonious, the orangutan, should be nominated for Best Supporting Actor. And I agree. Thelonious is tremendous in that film. And if we nominated animals, he should have got a nomination. Okay, let's talk about clothes calls, which I hate that name for this article.
Yeah.
Let's talk about these outfits. So
it's such a weird, it's a very short period of time. Like, I don't understand the parameters. Because I was like, oh, this will be from this year. And then I was like, no, obviously it's not because that hasn't happened yet. And then I was like, why have they picked these ones? Yeah. It's very confusing.
It's very strange. But let's just talk about the outfits for a brief moment here. Mira Sorvino's dress is interesting.
Her Armani, yeah.
I don't know how I feel about two different patterns on the same thing, but you know, that's a choice.
Yeah, it's a little muddled.
Then on the next page, I believe, because these are out of order, but yes, Helena Bonham Carter is just always the best. I don't know, she's always great. Holly Hunter, I remember that was, I believe, the did she wear that to the Oscars? Is that something she? I vaguely
1994 Oscars, so yeah.
That's when she won, I believe, for The Piano. Yes, I don't know what to say about Jada Pinkett.
I think it's fucking great. It's not specifically Oscars, but she looks banging.
She does. It looks like it's made of metal though. Like the top looks like it's a lot. It's
kind of love
rad.
It.
It's pretty rad. The Sharon Stone two outfits. I'm into the top kind of black. It looks like it's crushed velvet or something like that. It's kind of hard to see from here, but I thought that's pretty cool. On the next page, which is Patricia Arquette.
Yeah, not loving.
I have a real problem with like two-tone stuff, but that's, I mean.
It's kind of Cotillion-esque, kind of
this odd floral-ish pattern thing.
Yeah.
Her hair looks great, though. Dennis Rodman wearing just a giant Mad Hatter crushed velvet top hat thing. I don't really get it. Gus Van Sant wearing a interesting sort of blazer-ish thing.
Velvet. It looks, yeah.
It's looks like a lot of velvet going on in a lot of these photos. Anna Paquin in the outfit that she wore when she won for The Piano as well, which is crazy. She's great in that movie, but I just never really know how to feel about like children winning Academy Awards where it's just, and she's great in the movie, but Juliette Binoche, more velvet in this a great sort of crushed brown velvet thing when she beat Lauren Bacall and everyone thought it was crazy. For the Mirror Has Two Faces, which, I mean, okay. I mean, Lauren Bacall is great, but anyway. And then another picture of Anna Paquin later. She looks good, I guess.
It looks like it's from She's All That. It looks like it looks like the prom scene from She's All That.
And then on the last page, we have Brad and Gwyneth in peak Brad and Gwyneth times.
It's cool, yeah. It's cool. Like, you get, it's like Brad and Gwyneth were just like, were the ones.
They were the ones. I mean, I really do feel like of all the Brad and ... they were the ones that I liked the most.
Yeah.
Same. I always felt like Jennifer Aniston, whenever she was next to him, was like, I'm married to Brad Pitt. Like, it's just, there's just something very sort of adorable about it, but also kind of, whereas Gwyneth is just like, yeah, of course I'm with Brad Pitt.
I think it's also how they were positioned. Like, we talked about in the last one, how like Jen's the TV star and he's the movie star. Whereas mm-hmm. I guess they were kind of, obviously he was older than Gwyneth. I don't know by how much, but like, and he was already established, but it feels like they were more on the same level. And same with Angelina Jolie in a way, whereas Jennifer Aniston was always positioned as like, yeah, she's so lucky.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, as flawed as that movie might be. I find it a lot of fun. And the two of them are just so, like, they're just, they are, that is just star wattage off the charts, crazy, two unbelievably hot people just being hot and blowing things up. It's great. But I think about Brad and Gwyneth in Seven and what they had, and that energy is just, it's just richer and more interesting. But then there's Kim Basinger. I believe that's from the, is that from the Oscars? That's when she won for, is that the year that she won?
It doesn't say what year is, annoyingly. Yeah. Say what year is.
And then we have a triptych of Emma Thompson.
This is the weirdest article. I don't understand.
It doesn't make any sense. This is maybe the most. There's a couple times where I really feel like they're just like, we got to pad this thing.
Yeah. They're like, we got to use our Getty allowance this month.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, it's crazy.
Get these pictures. It's so weird. Like,
this article in particular really shows how much it's not a fashion magazine. Like, how right. They're just like, here's a hodgepodge of people dressed up.
Anyway. Yeah, it's really stupid.
It's really strange. So then the next issue we're skipping because they did four Star Wars covers. And they just
I love that all of us were like, we don't care. Like, I mean, Star Wars, it's just... There's plenty of Star Wars stuff already.
If you want to listen to podcasts about Star Wars, there's a million of them, and you'll be fine. But they did four different covers for the four stars. Obviously, Natalie Portman, Ewan McGregor, Liam Neeson, and Georgie and Jake Lloyd. I bought the next issue, but it got lost in the mail. So, but I got a refund, so I'm not too worried about it. But it would have been nice because I would have liked to have seen this sizzling summer preview. Salma Hayek is on the cover from everyone's favorite Wild Wild West, a movie that, wow, has not aged well. There's a Power 100 special report where they rank everybody. Would have loved to have seen who these people were at the time. and then there's my first love scene, Tales from the Set. Again. Bummer. Maybe someday I'll get this issue and we'll do a one-off on this one particular issue as a special bonus because I would actually like to talk about some of the things in it. But moving on to July, where we have Heather Graham, Bubblicious, on the cover. she is, she's in a, how would you describe this dress? Sort of a shiny... How would you describe this?
Green tube top metallic dress.
Yeah, it's I'm pulling up the PDF of the issue just so I have it.
Of course, I closed my thing. Large. Did it feel very
it looks like it's like a hologram kind of ish. There we go. For the people who have paid to see the video.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
You can see it.
Yeah. It kind of feels like maybe Austin Powers, but not. Like, they're like, this kind of will make you think of Austin Powers, but it's not Austin Powers.
Correct. There's a couple other articles in this issue. There's a very detailed breakdown of the pod race shot by shot from Star Wars The Phantom Menace. There's an article with John Sayles talking about an interesting article about him sort of talking about his... I guess his fights with studios, and you know he's sort of one of the American independent auteurs. There's an article about 10 terrific scripts that Hollywood hasn't made and might never make. There's only one, I believe, on there that got made.
Yeah, Good Shepherd, I think.
Good Shepherd got made, but we'll talk about those. There's a really interesting article about Julia versus Julia, which breaks down the Notting Hill Runaway Bride situation in 99, which is that Notting Hill shot first, obviously. Universal is, as we described earlier, struggling. And I believe they purchased that movie or a portion of that film from Working Title. I think it's Working Title or Polygram. It's a British imprint.
It's Working Title. Yeah.
So they buy half that film and they're unsure when to release it. And it's basically this game of chicken between Paramount and Universal as to when these two films are going to get released. Paramount refuses to move their release date from I believe it's August. I think it's August. Maybe it's July. Doesn't matter. They won't move it. And ultimately, Notting Hill blinks. They decide to release Notting Hill the week after Star Wars as counter-programming, and it does incredibly well, much, much better than Runaway Bride. But Runaway Bride probably does better because it's in the wake of the success of Notting Hill, so it ultimately all kind of works out. But it's just an interesting thing. Anyway, and then 50 Unsung Classics. We'll talk about that. But let's talk about this Heather Graham article. Wow. So much to talk about. Let's talk about, first of all, the photography within the piece. Do you have it in front of you, Emma? No,
maybe. I can
email it to you. It's very odd photographs. Would you say, Tori? Do you have it? I can send it to you guys. Hold on 1 second. You do have it?
Yeah.
I'm emailing it to you right now, Emma. okay. Well, it's one of these big files, so you might not be able to open it. Because
I've definitely seen it. I'll pull them up whilst you're talking.
Okay. She's wearing a bunch of tanner. She's wearing several very scandalous outfits that I don't actually think are particularly sexy, if I'm being honest.
No.
The first one is this like lace. Would you say it's lace, Tori?
Yeah.
This lace, black lace situation where that's see-through. And she's got this kind of pseudo leopard print shoes. The true confessions of Heather Graham from Boogie Nights to Austin Powers. She punctures her angelic image by playing sexual adventurers. Off screen, she's not so sure whether she's a saint or a sinner. Okay. So this article is gross. It's gross for a bunch of reasons, but it's gross because I'm just like, enough with Ed Burns and her just like making out while they're talking.
Insane.
Like,
So many comments about that in the article.
There's a moment when says the only good thing about LA is Heather Graham. I mean, okay. Sure. I had a big crush on Heather Graham too. So like, I get it. I mean, there she is. Yeah. But like Ed Burns, come on. Anyway. And
they
like
don't watch TV apart from 60 Minutes.
When they said that. Oh my God. Minutes.
Like they watch 60 Minutes. And then she follows it up by saying, we make out a lot.
Yeah. She loves her. The stuff about the interior design, about how she hadn't picked any of the pieces out herself and her friend had decorated it.
Yep.
That was just amazing.
She comes across as really, really stupid. And it's unfortunate, but they really do. This Tori bats away her cat. It's amazing. She comes across as really dumb, and that's maybe the hatchet part of it is twofold. She comes across as not particularly smart, but then on top of it, there's the James Woods component.
That's so weird. It's like it's actually fucked up,
right? It's fucked up. It's fucked up on multiple levels. So James Woods, of course, James Woods set his sights on Heather Graham because James Woods is, spoiler, a monster. In case you guys hadn't been reading the news, the guy's like a fucking terrible person. And she's probably in her early 20s around the time that he's, you know, decided that he wants to be with her. And he's easily in his 50s, probably, is my guess. Maybe late 40s. Long story short, they briefly go out. The interviewer brings this up. Now, it's very rare when I'm reading a piece like this where I actually feel the awkwardness of the situation and no longer want to be there anymore. And you can sense, I could feel how much Heather Graham didn't want to talk about this, how it was clearly something that she was embarrassed about. They go back to it several times.
And she's like, "You rang him?" And she's like, "Yeah." And it's like, because he's obviously quite complimentary of her, where she's like, "It's the worst like dating situation like I've had. I'm really embarrassed."
It's like dating your father or something that she's said.
And then don't even get me started on another article that's coming down the Lily Sobieski. The Lily Sobieski one, where she's like, "I've taken down all the pictures of like hot young men and put up old people," but that's neither here nor there. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But yeah, this was definitely just a very uncomfortable article that was sexualizing her, but also talking about how, like, it felt like the interviewer or the article was getting off on the idea of someone who clearly had a religious upbringing, someone who was very restrained and very sort of had issues with sex, and then being like, but now she's a big star, and isn't Hollywood great because now she can finally show herself having sex with people? I just don't really get it.
Yeah, and it's like the bit about where she's like, "I'd rather, like, fake orgasms on screen and getting stabbed," which is actually a valid point, and it goes back to some of the other like, it seems like there's this thread of like sex and violence throughout quite a few of these articles, and that point where you're like, "Oh yeah, then that actually makes sense," but then she gets referred to as having a sinewy body, which is like,
it's so uncomfortable. It really is. I mean, it's what's interesting too is, so this run for her is Drugstore Cowboy, Boogie Nights, Austin Powers, Bowfinger, which is quite a run. And it's understandable why she was, you know, the it girl for a moment. I think Bowfinger is interesting. Have you guys seen Bowfinger?
No.
Okay. Bowfinger is actually a really funny, it's a Steve Martin written film directed... stories. Cat is amazing. The best part of this is we can't see the cat, so it's just Tori looking crazy swatting at nothing off screen. It's phenomenal. So basically Bowfinger is kind of making fun. It is making fun of Hollywood. It's making fun of everything, every part of Hollywood. And she is quite funny in it as an actress who is trying to basically sleep her way to the top and kind of using her sex attraction, what have you, all of that to get roles. And then at the end, it seems like in a dig at Anne Hesh, she's a lesbian at the end, but that's neither here nor there. I guess what I'm getting at is I feel like, unfortunately, the sex kitten thing gets away from her to a certain extent. And then it kind of just feels like that's all that people want from her. And it's sad. Okay. But I love Heather Graham and I'd love to see her do more things. That would be great. Lost and Profound is this piece about 50 unsung movies. There was a bunch of stuff on here, quite frankly, that I have not seen. So I will go through this list and I will watch a lot of these films. There are some films that I have seen that I would absolutely ride for. After Hours is a masterpiece of weird, dark, twisted comedy. If you haven't seen it, definitely watch it. I'm a big fan of Steve Kloves, who wrote Wonder Boys, adapted a bunch of the Harry Potter movies. Fabulous Baker Boys is one of my favorite films from 1989. He did a film called Flesh and Bone in 93, which is really quite good. The Long Goodbye is also amazing. If you haven't seen the Robert Altman film, it's tremendous. We'll post this list on our Twitter feed so people can see this list. A lot of great films on here. Near Dark, that Catherine Bigelow vampire movie is fucking great too. But there's just not like a lot to dive into here because I don't think we've seen a lot of these films. So
no, I've seen four. I counted.
I've seen like two.
Yeah. So again, the list is good because it is unsung movies that need to be seen. So
I saved it.
There you go. A Scandalous Affair. this Independent Spirit Awards piece is pointless. I don't know why it exists in this issue. I don't know what the point of it is. It feels so padded. The photos aren't even good. Like these photos are just like weird. Like that picture, the picture at the top of Christina Ricci's bad. It's like a bunch of poke quotes and like people being asked questions that I don't really get. And it's dumb.
Can I just say, there is one that I like. So it's like, you know, what's the worst rumor that could be heard about you? And it was Laura Flynn Boyle who said, there's no such thing as a bad rumor, which I found funny because there's been so many bad rumors about her. Especially because of Twin Peaks. I was just like, wow, okay.
Yeah, it's and her romance with Jack Nicholson, which also, so there's that. Uncut Gems is this 10 best screenplays in Hollywood that are still waiting for a green light. Most of them seem like I understand why they haven't been made. Like a lot of these things are just like, yeah, no, I totally get it. Some of them are interesting. This $20 billion, this Mike Tolkien script about sort of this kind of Bill Gates type computer whiz who's given this extraordinary opportunity to basically fly off the planet seems very much of the world we live in right now, when two billionaires just shot themselves into space for 10 minutes for no fucking reason while people starve and die. Anyway, The Good Shepherd, as we mentioned, is the one film on this list that did get made into a very boring movie that kind of doesn't really exist. I don't really like that movie. The rest of them are movies that are sort of understandable. The only one that jumped out at me here is A Confederacy of Dunces.
Which famously is cursed.
Famously cursed.
That was never made.
Great book. If you haven't read Confederacy of Dunces, you should read it. It won the Pulitzer posthumously. The author, John Kennedy Toole, committed suicide. His mother found the book in his bedroom. It was published. He won the Pulitzer. It's a very, very good book. It's begging to be an HBO limited series. I'm assuming that at some point someone will make it into a limited somewhere. It just feels like the type of thing that, should get made. Okay. August. On the cover, we have Brad and Ed Norton talking about Fight Club. There's an article about the scariest movies, summer scariest movies, sure. There's a Michelle Williams piece, which we'll talk about. There's a giant Kubrick piece, which is interesting, but also sort of like doesn't really unearth anything new about Stanley Kubrick for the most part. The main sort of, there's... the best piece, I would argue, maybe of this entire thing that we've done is this piece on actors. It is so much gossip, so much good shit in this thing. It's all about star power and how actors are the ones that really rule Hollywood. They're the ones that get pictures made, and it's their taste that essentially gets things made. Now, it's kind of true, right? It's no longer true. Now, in IP and intellectual property is the only thing that anybody seems to care about in franchises. But back in the day, if Julia Roberts says, I want to make your movie, that movie gets made, right? Like they read that script, they decide they want to make that movie, it happens. So it's not that this article is incorrect. It's that this article is fucking bonkers. And it's filled with a bunch of castings that make no sense. It's filled with great Vin Diesel gossip, which is tremendous. But it also has the best first sentence of any of the articles, which I will read. Most young actors would give up smoking, hawk their Ducati cycles, and shave off their goatees for the opportunity to work on a project as promising as Reindeer Games. It's a time capsule in and of itself. It is a perfect distillation of so many things that I was just like, I love this so much. Basically, the piece opens with this whole thing about Reindeer Games, a movie that kind of doesn't really exist. If for anyone who might remember, Ben Affleck, Charlize Theron, Gary Sinise, it's kind of just a heist movie set at winter at Christmas, which is why it's called Reindeer Games. I don't know. I don't know what else there is to say. It's John Frankenheimer, who, you know, had an illustrious career in the early days of his career, did some amazing movies. Anyway, Vin Diesel was supposed to be in this. Vin Diesel had notes at a time in Vin Diesel's career where, quite frankly, No one knew who he really was. This is before Fast and the Furious. He's had like 15 minutes of screen time in Saving Private Ryan. He's very good in it, but whatever. So Vin Diesel's been Vin Diesel since birth, apparently. And we should not be surprised by this fact. But he had notes and the director's like, go fuck yourself, and kicks him off the movie, which is just fantastic.
Do you think they were Fellini-esque? That's why I'm wondering.
I think they must have been, right? They must have been Fellini-esque. Oh my God. I mean, oh my God. His whole thing about teaching The Rock how to act recently I wish I saw that conversation. Oh my God.
Yeah.
The ego of Vin Diesel is really something to be impressed by, quite honestly. So the top of this article says one studio heads. One studio heads were the unquestioned kings of the movie business. Then directors, producers, and power agents called the shots. No longer on the eve of the 21st century, the unspoken reality of today's Hollywood is that actors rule. There's a really interesting section of this article which talks about the various deal points that these actors ask for now. So I'm going to read some of these because it will surprise no one that no one gets these anymore. Like, I think that there's like five people that could make these demands now in Hollywood. But at the time, I imagine there was probably far more. Screenplay approval, director approval, cast approval, credits as to where their credits are on the actual film and on the poster, schedule, likeness, nudity, publicity and marketing, travel, foreign tax indemnification, final cut, managers, and most favored nation. So these are all things that these actors were demanding in their contracts at the time. And now you're lucky if you get basically anything. A lot of actors, their big thing now, ultimately, or at least the ones that can make these demands, are back end participation, right? Which is they'll take less on the front end and they'll take it on the back end in the success of the film, and they'll make far more money off of it. And obviously, merchandising and various things like that are still very much for big actors a big deal. The other things that jumped out at me in this article are that John Travolta and Billy Bob Thornton were going to be in The Shipping News, which makes literally no sense to me. The Shipping News, which now is notoriously the movie that stars Kevin Spacey, unfortunately.
Also, was it famously known that he often uses a teleprompter? How does that even work? Like,
it's so crazy to me that any publication... Can you, like, right now, that would be a tweet that would maybe catch on and people would be like, wait, what now? This publication is saying that these actors don't know their lines and that they have a teleprompter in front of them to say their lines. It's crazy. It's crazy. Notoriously has a teleprompter, which I think is an amazing thing. For anyone who's read The Shipping News, and I imagine that you guys have not read it nor have seen the film, and that's completely fine. The book won the Pulitzer. It's a really lovely book about a man who's struggling with sort of an existential crisis in Newfoundland. He's this sort of sad sack, kind of a weirdo in his own way, and his wife is cheating on him. And it's all kind of the sort of the drama that happens in this small Newfoundland town. There is no fucking version of this book where John Travolta is playing the main character or, quite frankly, Billy Bob Thornton. Kevin Spacey's wrong in a completely different way, but it's just so baffling to me that these guys were ever in talks for that. There was talk of Nicolas Cage and Mel Gibson for A Perfect Storm, but they couldn't make the deal happen, so it becomes George Clooney. And obviously that film is a big success. It's just, this article is just filled with so much weird Hollywood shit that I love. Just the, like... Tom Cruise and the whole Mission Impossible 2 stuff. I love that there's a quote here. During Mission Impossible 2, Tom Cruise got under the hood and tinkered with the script late into the night, tearing it apart, then rebuilding entire arcs. Mission Impossible 2 notoriously having basically no fucking script and no plot. Like, that movie is
and that's why, I guess. Also, I'm not thinking, because obviously there's that Tandy Newton interview where she talks about his, like, pimple growing in front of her. Yes.
She's like just watching him just build a pimple out of just sheer willpower is just incredible. So then the writer, Wesley Strick, says, Tom is amazingly focused, especially for an actor of his stature. I was amazed at the amount of hard labor he was willing to do hour after hour. Wesley Strick, who now does not have, I believe, a screenwriting credit on Mission Impossible 2. So like, it just goes to show that like these scripts are being just like fucked with on so many levels. They talk about Payback, which is obviously a very notorious Mel Gibson fiasco with Brian Helgeland, who was the screenwriter and director of that film. They talk about, again, another notorious film was Harrison Ford and The Devil's Own. Him and Brad Pitt got into it a fair amount on that film. There's also talk of Julia Roberts showing interest in Shakespeare in Love as well. Julia Roberts in Shakespeare in Love.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I sort of, like, my brain can sort of understand it, which is, again, she'd give us that pseudo-British accent that Gwyneth is giving us. And it, I imagine it, but, like, Julia Roberts would just swallow that movie. Like, I just think
yeah.
that, like,
yeah.
So, but I think it's so interesting that Shakespeare in Love, as a script, is clearly a script that's, like, beloved and is making its way through all of these different channels. It's a movie that inevitably was going to get made. It's understandable why. It's clever, but not too clever. It's post Romeo and Juliet. And there was that moment on Twitter last week when everyone decided that Romeo and Juliet was not a good movie for some fucking yeah. unknown reason.
I ignored it. I was like, I don't want to see this.
I'm not touching that.
Yeah. I was just like, what are we doing? It anyway. So that, like, yeah.
Well, there was the thing with Shakespeare in Love, wasn't there? That Gwyneth Paltrow allegedly stole the script from Winona Ryder's house.
Correct.
Like,
yep.
Which
yep.
is, yeah. That's yeah. The rumor.
It's just, it's amazing. So then you've got that whole thing. It's just interesting. Romeo and Juliet really kind of opens the doors to Shakespeare adaptations and metatextual interpretations of Shakespeare and all of that. And then Shakespeare in Love just really capitalizes on that. So it's understandable why this script was such a big deal. That being said, some of the people that got attached to it is interesting. The other person that I think we'd be remiss to not talk about for a second here, because he comes up in several of these issues, is Adam Sandler. It's a crazy thing. They talk a little bit about how Adam Sandler oversees every comma of Big Daddy's script. And I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that there's, I mean, I'm not going to say that's wrong, but I also feel like Adam Sandler is a brand. Adam Sandler understands his brand, understands what people like about his films. I'm amazed by how many different articles give him a kick in the nuts over the course of this.
It's the gray 90s one, basically. It's so rude.
And that article we'll talk about when we get to it, because that article is also fucking crazy. But I did think, like, it is interesting how in a time of like Jim Carrey and Mike Myers and a lot of these sort of very big comedic stars, that Adam Sandler is seen as the lesser than, like the, oh, he's not, his stuff is just lowbrow and stupid and whatever. Whereas like Mike Myers stuff is so high-minded and Jim Carrey stuff is so intellectual. It's just interesting how Adam Sandler just rakes in, builds an empire all while everyone's being like poo-pooing him. It's just very odd. I don't really get it.
No.
There's then, within this article on actors, there's a whole thing about the perks that they ask for. Again, different time, 1999. Motorhome, driver, cook, limousine driver, rental car, jet fuel, three-bedroom hotel suite, nanny, assistant publicist, security stand-in, trainer, gym equipment rental, personal hairstylist, personal makeup artist, personal wardrober, fringes, which is just like just put there, like whatever that might mean, per diem, which is $42,000 to the power of four. So I guess that's basically like they just, you know, get, you know, $200,000 or whatever. And then miscellaneous allowances. These are all just things that people don't think about that actors are sort of still getting and are baked into their contracts, baked into these films. You wonder why a film costs $200 million. It's because you have all of this bullshit. It's crazy. So yeah, this article is great. I loved every minute of it. It was filled with gossip and nonsense, and it was fantastic.
I want more of this. People give us more of these articles.
they know better not to, because it would ruin their careers. Nobody would do this.
Yeah, it's true. No access, like, ever.
Well, no access. And if imagine Vulture came to UM and was like, can you please just do a piece, a hatchet piece on why actors are fucking assholes?
It's weird, isn't it? It's like, you just wouldn't do it now.
You wouldn't do it.
Someone else should, though.
Should do it. I'd love to read it. Please do it. Yeah. Love to read it. The Brad Pitt, Edward Norton thing. So I want to talk about Fight Club for a second. We touched on it a little bit when we talked about Brad on the cover of Rolling Stone in his sort of gender fluid Tyler Durden-ness, which I think is one of the things that's aged best about this movie is perhaps that. I think this movie is very complicated. I look forward to us unpacking it on our Fight Club episode when we get to it. Because I think it's a really complicated, really interesting film. And I think that this article really kind of hits on a bunch of those things. But what are your thoughts on Fight Club? Have you seen it recently? Have you seen it at all? Does it hold up for you? As obviously as women, I'm very curious as to how the film feels to you guys.
I haven't seen it for a long time. Yeah, I really liked it when I did. But okay. Yeah. It's been a while.
Talk, guys.
Sorry. It's been a while.
No, no, no. Although it's fine.
I knew I knew the twist. That was my thing. I knew the twist when I saw it.
I kind of knew everything about it before.
Oh, okay. See, that's a book.
So it kind of... I've read the book, actually.
Which is very different.
Yeah.
I think that the movie is grossly misinterpreted by a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, yeah.
I think that it became this bro-y bastion for, like, aggro white dudes that felt like the world was passing them by and didn't realize that this film is actually mocking them and is actually a takedown of them. So I think that gets lost in the interpretation of it. Similar in a weird way to The Matrix as well, which sort of got taken over by this whole red pill, blue pill nonsense too, which is its whole thing. So like both of these films in 99 are real lightning rods of misinterpretation. That being said, I went to see Fight Club in a theater with a female friend of mine probably a couple years ago now. The theater was 95%, 96% men. And hearing an audience filled with men laugh at some of these jokes did make me go, oh no, I don't know that this movie is totally, I think it's still being misinterpreted.
Right.
Unfortunately, the dark comedic elements of it. And I would argue in this article, Brad and Edward are both being very kind of like cutesy.
Yeah.
And sort of frustratingly so of being like, we've made such an edgy movie and like, aren't we they're the canary. They're so like the cat that ate the canary the whole fucking time. That I'm just like, would you please just
they said
stop?
They're like when Brad speaks, which is rarely.
And Edward, who speaks a lot. Yeah. It's like, it's also, I think my feeling is that they must have been pretty insufferable to interview for this article.
Oh yeah, she hates them. She definitely hates them. Like that's like the laugh sound when they're talking. I think it's they're talking about it's like Beavis and Butthead laugh though. It's so weird. Like, yeah, and I think she makes a comment about them being like teenage potheads.
Yeah, who don't remember the night before. Like, interviewing them was like.
It really feels like she's sitting there just being like, oh, for fuck's sake, will you give me a straight answer, please? Like, it's a lot of that. And I think part of it too is, and I do get it. Like, I'm sure that if you're Brad Pitt and Edward Norton and David Fincher, and you're getting to make this movie at this time, which must have felt like such a taking down sacred cows thing, right? Like, it's crazy that a studio made it, really, when you think about it. And it's not a surprise that they had no idea how to market it, or maybe Fincher knew how to market it, but they wouldn't let him do totally what he wanted to do. So it's this push and pull of the marketing campaign that's kind of odd. It's not a surprise that the film isn't a hit. But, you know, it's what it is, and it's such a big movie. It still leaves a big footprint. I think they just got off so much on the, like, look at what we're doing of it all. I don't think that Fincher was maybe as much as they were.
No, like, he came across, I think, less douchey. Or, like, how come he was only 37? That was upsetting. Just because I'm like, that's younger than me now. But I will say, do you know what? She gets, like, a bit of revenge by calling them medium tall, which I found... hilarious. Like, what a better way to upset an actor to call them medium tall.
Medium tall is such a great shade. I mean, it's such an amazing thing.
And skinny as ferret? That doesn't sound hot. Like,
she was having fun after this interview.
Medium tall, skinny ferrets is quite the description. I get the impression that Edward Norton was probably way more insufferable than Brad was in this equation.
Where he like bought the same truck as him and was like,
and Brad didn't even notice. No idea. That's the best part. The best part is like Ed being like, yeah, I bought this car, didn't you? And he's like, yeah, no, I didn't. And then Ed would be like, they wouldn't let me buy the same one as you, so it wasn't this big. Like, why'd you own yourself? You self-owned yourself so many times.
Why are you telling the story? Yeah, and there's like, I'm sure she mentioned something about Nietzsche as well. Like, there's something like, mm-hmm. Oh, I bet you read Nietzsche as well. And she's just like, ugh.
It's just a lot. It's a lot of, like, I imagine being a female, like, a woman interviewing these two guys about this film, which I'm sure they didn't want to be imbued with fratty humor or anything like that. But they do come across that way in this interview. Like, I don't think that that's intentional necessarily, but it's all just crazy. Mm-hmm. It's a great article if you're interested in seeing probably what Brad Pitt and Edward Norton are still like a little bit. I like to think that Brad's a little more enlightened and maybe Edward is too, but this is them at the peak of their powers, right? Like, I don't know that Edward Norton would ever be bigger and more sort of critically lauded than him coming into Fight Club.
It's also weird because they mentioned it's only his sixth movie, which is kind of insane when you think about that.
Well, what's insane is what his first six movies were. That's kind of the thing.
True, yeah.
It's like, and I'll just quickly pull them up here just so I'm not speaking out of school because I can't totally remember them. But they are, bear with me a quick second here.
I'm guessing Primal Fear is number one, right? Like his first one.
Primal Fear, I believe, was his first one. And then, God damn it. What is going on here? We'll cut all of this, right, Will? Yeah. Yes, great, thanks. First film, Primal Fear, then Everyone Says I Love You, The People vs. Larry Flint, American History X, Rounders, then Fight Club. It's a weird career. He definitely struggles with, I don't want to say fame because that makes it seem almost glib. Like, I think he's struggling with, like, like every one of these fucking, you know, he wants to be Brando. He wants to shake the system and change the thing and do, you know, but also within the studio system, but also wants to be famous. And also, you know what I mean? Like, so there's just all this kind of stuff going on. I do think it's interesting that he starts dating Courtney Love on People versus Larry Flint. And she is almost cast as Marla Singer in Fight Club. Yeah. I think Helena Bonham Carter is amazing in Fight Club, and I would never, ever want anyone else to play the role. Courtney Love would have been interesting, though. I don't know what that is, but that'd be interesting. Yeah. The other articles in this issue are an issue on The Haunting, which looked like a pretty crazy shoot in terms of the builds. Like, there's a lot of practicality of that house, which looked really fun. The cast is insane. For anyone who hasn't seen The Haunting, it's Liam Neeson, Lily Taylor, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Owen Wilson, because those four people make sense together. It's a very boring movie. But it, you know, it's just not good. But the production looked relatively cool, even if the movie's boring. There's a Michelle Williams piece, which is very brief. She is very young in that picture. She looks like a different person.
The styling is fucking awful as well. Like, it's so bad. Like, they put so much makeup on her face. Like, it's just,
she looks awful.
It's such a weird, like, again, I'm like, what are you doing with teenagers? Again, and she's smoking in it, and they're like, smoking. She's doing smoking. A play with nudity. Divorced, like, emancipated her parents.
15.
Like, it's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. There's a lot of emancipation going on in these issues. There was another one, too. Heather Graham did it. Like, and I feel like Lily Sobieski was very close to doing it. It was just all like, what's happening? But the Michelle Williams thing, which is interesting, is she's obviously got a fascinating career. She's one of the best actors that we have right now. But seeing sort of those early years of her trying to find her way post Dawson's Creek of, you know, how to kind of forge a career for herself. She's so good in Dick. You guys have seen Dick, I'm assuming.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Dick's the best. And they're both of them are so fucking funny in that movie. I wish they I want them to do another comedy together.
Oh,
like, how do we make me that happen?
Too. That would be happen. So good.
I would give anything for that. I would give it anything for like a sequel to Dick, but it's in the Trump administration and it's just them. Yeah. They're still friends and they're just the age they are now. I would watch the fuck out of that. Someone needs to make that. Then there's a thing on the Blair Witch Project, which is structured like Blair.
Okay, it's dumb, but can I just bring it up? Because in the letters page, the following issue, there are people mad because they think it's real.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they had to be like, this wasn't real, guys. Like,
well, it's
there's someone mad about the Brad Pitt interview saying that the interviewer is being all like horny over them, and it's like, she's not being horny, like, she fucking hates them.
It's amazing.
Didn't get that vibe at all.
there's just, this is the thing that unfortunately, because of, quite frankly, we can't do a 6-hour podcast on these issues, but like, there's a whole bunch of subsections within these issues that are actually a lot of fun too, in terms of just all the little kind of tidbits and little things that they were doing at the time. They do a review section as well, obviously, but they also do kind of, to your point, this kind of letters to the magazine being like, they're the best because they're fair. Like, I want people, like, I'm surprised. There's a reason why I guess people don't do this anymore, but it's a lot of people being like, stop being so mean to these people that I love. And they're just like, all right, it's great. Then there's the Stop the Madness thing, which is all on Cannes from 1999, which was an interesting year in the sense of the films that I think were overlooked by Cannes at the time. Specifically, The Straight Story and The Limey and Ghost Dog are all great films that I feel like, I get that they went all in on Rosetta, which is an interesting film, and I look forward to talking about it on the podcast at some point, but Cronenberg was running the jury at the time, and that he overlooks Adam McGoyan's film is such a fuck you. Like, from one Canadian to another being like, yeah, no, I'm not interested in this movie, is amazing. I also love that Spike is all upset about how Summer of Sam is being received. But like, Summer of Sam is not that good. So like, I'm kind of like, I kind of understand why Cam was like, we're not really into this. But then I love that Spike led the jury this year. And then accidentally said what the Palme d'Or was first.
So good.
Which is fantastic. Can't wait to see Titan. That movie looks bug nuts and can't wait. The Lime is another one that I'm sort of surprised Soderbergh was so, someone who was such a can regular, obviously did very well with Sex, Lies, and Videotape 10 years earlier, kind of surprised that The Limey didn't get a little bit more love. And The Straight Story, which I think is such a beautiful David Lynch film, and I'm kind of surprised didn't get a little bit more love. But All About My Mother is fantastic. The best.
Amazing.
It's so good. So yeah, September, Michelle Pfeiffer's on the cover. Everyone's my favorite Michelle Pfeiffer. I love her to death. I wish she had a better 99 in terms of the films that she made. I actually liked A Midsummer Night's Dream, but Story of Us and Deep End of the Ocean are very good. But I do love that she's just, she's very specific about her, the way she's perceived, very controlling, understandably so, of her image and of the things that she makes and why she makes them. I just love her. I was so bummed that she didn't get nominated for French Exit, which I really loved last year. And I thought might have been the year that she would finally win, quite frankly. Wasn't even nominated. I just feel like this town just doesn't give her the respect that she deserves. I think she's made so many just absolutely magnificent films. And just seeing this cover, which is, I mean, this is 99, and like she's still like the most beautiful woman in the world, and she still is now, and I love her to death. And she's just so cool and doesn't give a shit. Like, she basically, the whole article is her being like, yeah, so I'm basically semi-retired. Like, I'm just not really
gonna do this anymore. Well, the fact that, like, you're 41, it's like...
Yeah.
I don't know why. Yeah. It feels like they're saying 41 is quite old, which I guess I maybe in 99 was. And I guess because it wasn't, TV didn't have the same role that it has now, where obviously when you hit a certain age as an actress, TV tends to be the place where you get your most interesting parts.
Yeah, and I get the impression too, especially, I mean, she did a fair amount of press for French Exit and talked a lot about how, like, she was raising her kids and she was just like, I didn't need to do a bunch of movies. I mean, when you're married to David E. Kelly, I imagine that's part of it too, in terms of just like, you know, you don't need to bring in as much money. That's not a judgment. I'm just saying, like, that's just a thing. And she spent many years raising her kids and, you know, nothing wrong with that. I do wish that the times that she did make films that perhaps those films were just different movies sometimes, but that's what it is. She'll do What Lies Beneath in 2000 with Harrison Ford, and that's obviously a big hit. And I actually kind of like What Lies Beneath. I think there's some... I want the bathroom at the very least in my future.
I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember liking it when I did.
Yeah, I like it.
It's very Hitchcockian. Like, it's just, it's Smeck is doing Hitchcock, but I dig it.
she said she's been on the internet twice.
Yeah. First of all, I love the perception of the internet.
Yes.
Like, just the idea that it's like a place you go for a vacation. Like, I'm going to go to the internet for a little bit. I don't really get it. There's a piece on this Kiss Me Deadly thing, which I'm a little confused by what it was supposed... I don't really understand it. Do you guys understand it?
I realized I didn't, because I thought I had this one, but I've only read the Michelle Pfeiffer, because I was like, oh, I've read Michelle Pfeiffer, that's cool. I realized I didn't get any, I didn't ask for the other one.
It's all good,
so
no worries.
Totally.
No, it's all good. there's this, it's like a photo shoot with James Marsden and Bridget Wilson.
Yeah.
Two people that you know, James Marsden's had a career, but it's kind of an odd one, and Bridget Wilson obviously kind of disappeared. But it's sort of this odd sort of pseudo photo shoot thing that I just didn't really get. And then there's the Lily Sobieski article, which is very strange.
Weird.
Did you? Yeah, you read it, Tori?
Yeah.
So first of all, with no disrespect to Lily Sobieski, but like the fact that there was a moment when Hollywood was like, this is the girl, is a little bit, I mean, she doesn't have that much range. She's very stunning. She's attractive. She's got this kind of interesting look to her, which is why she has her two scenes in Eyes Wide Shut, which she gave off the vibe that obviously the Kubrick wanted. There's a line in it where she says, I'm taking she took Johnny Depp and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers off her wall and replaced them with Kris Kristofferson, Hugh Hefner, and Morgan Freeman. And then she says, I have this feeling with men over 60. It's wild, yeah. Right? Like,
how old is she in the interview?
Is she like 16 or something?
Yeah, 17, 16 or 17.
Wow.
It's,
yikes.
Like today, that would just, you wouldn't put that in an article, right? Like you just would be like, no.
Yeah.
And then she says, this is a quote. She's asked about Hugh Hefner by the interviewer. And she says, how fun is it that this guy built a whole empire based on breasts and asses? It's funny.
So weird.
Wow. Like, was this, well, I guess this was just before Girls of the Playboy Mansion like became a show. So maybe I guess they were kind of ramping up to
it's Playboy. It's weird. It's weird. I don't like it. I don't like it. It's a bummer. So moving on to October. On the cover is Winona Ryder and Angelina Jolie for Girl Interrupted. It's the quote-unquote Vanguard Hollywood issue. And I'm still a little unclear as to what that really means. I've read the issue and I'm still sort of like, I guess it's their sort of auteurs, people that kind of push the boundaries of things, I guess, sort of. I'm not... So the Hall of the Vanguard Hall of Fame thing.
That was very
what
weird.
What the fuck was that, right?
Again, I was filler. Like, right? It was definitely
filler. Didn't they compare Christina Ricci to Brigitte Bardot?
Yes. And I was like, correct. They okay. do. I'm pulling up the, just so I have it in front of me, the was, actual.
Like categories so are so weird. The misfit. So
the categories are super strange. There's, I'm just pulling it up here so I can talk
blessed
about
the and photos. Cursed. It was like people who died from drug overdoses. It was so weird.
It's a very strange, it's definitely padding. There's just a lot of like, for people that don't have the issue in front of them, for our listeners, it's very big pictures, not a lot of text. Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of like misfits and bombshells and like these kind of odd monikers, like radical cheek and having like the great dictator. You're just like, but what does that fucking mean? And then new eccentrics, they have the Coen brothers. I mean, okay. Outcasts, they have very strange choices for a lot of these people. Blessed and cursed, as you mentioned, people that died from drug overdoses. Just a lot of odd. I just didn't get it. It's long. It's like 20 pages. So just, anyway. Like,
that, do you think someone like something like, I feel like something fell through and they were like, fuck, we need something really quickly.
Yeah.
Everyone all night.
Yeah. It really it feels does. That way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there's the Martin Scorsese and Spike Lee piece, which is really interesting. They've worked together, obviously. Scorsese produced Clockers, Spike Lee's film Clockers. It's a really fascinating piece. First of all, to hear Scorsese talking about how his next film would be Gangs of New York, which is the first one that he does with Leonardo DiCaprio, obviously, and a notoriously fraught movie that I've watched on several occasions and been like, what could have been? Like there's
you know, I saw in seventh grade history class we watched Gangs of New York.
What?
Such really? A specific memory. Yes.
What?
That's so how old are you in seventh grade?
Like 12 maybe.
Wow.
That's not appropriate.
I think it was like one of the things where like you would fast forward. Not appropriate.
did they fast forward through things?
Through things, no yeah. way.
Oh, they did. Okay. Yeah, because like Daniel Day-Lewis gives like an entire monologue about like oral sex. And it's just, that movie's not okay for 12-year-olds. It's, I guess what I mean when I say what could have been, and this is notorious, you know, Harvey Weinstein shit, where like, Scorsese wanted to make Gangs of New York for a very long time. It was a book that he wanted to adapt, went through many, many scripts, many writers. It was a passion project of his. And Scorsese goes to Weinstein and Weinstein gets him the money to get it made, right? Like ponies up the money. And Weinstein thought it was going to be more Oscars. He thought it was going to be like the big Oscar movie. He thought it was going to make lots of money. Why would you think that? It's a 3-hour period piece about gangs in New York. And like, it's one of those things where like, if left to his devices, Scorsese would have made a film that I think would have been much longer, quite frankly, more interesting, wouldn't have been sort of forced into certain choices. I probably wouldn't have cast Leonardo DiCaprio and Cameron Diaz. Cameron Diaz is just so miscast in that movie. It's the crazy.
The accent is upsetting. I love but Cameron for the accent.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
And like, listen, Daniel Day-Lewis is magnetic. I'd watch him, you know, read a phone book. And he is a reason to watch the film, as is the production design and the production across the board, the costumes, all of it. But there's a masterpiece movie there, and instead we're given like a B-minus movie, and it's a bummer. Mm-hmm. I love Scorsese and Spike Lee both talking about how they don't care about winning Oscars. Come on now. Like, they want their Oscars. They're just like, yeah. You know. So there's that. What are your thoughts on the Winona Ryder Angelina Jolie article?
I was like, we both paused. Yeah, it's interesting.
It's very much like we're not friends.
Yeah. I mean, I love that book and I love that movie. So I'm going to come at it from that. But yeah, it's interesting how they're trying to write about this movie that's about women. It's actually, I think, a female writer as well, but it feels like they're trying to write about it as if it's guys in a weird way. Yep. Like, there's that whole, like, is Angelina being method kind of thing. It made me sad because Brittany Murphy comes across as like an amazing person. That made me cut on me.
And how everyone would leave on the weekends and Winona would stay with Elizabeth Moss.
Like, except 16. For Winona Ryder.
Yeah, like, the fact that Elizabeth Moss is 16 when she's doing that movie is kind of insane. It's a weird one because, it's like, it's such a, and when they talk about Winona Ryder's, the fact that she was like, in a psychiatric hospital in the early 90s, which felt like a revelation I didn't necessarily know.
It was like a week or like a month or something.
Yeah, she left after a week. Yeah, she didn't stay very long. It's a very, I thought it was a fascinating piece. I really liked it for a bunch of reasons. I, similar to you guys, do really love that movie. I think that movie is underrated, and I wish that movie was the beginning of the next chapter of Winona Ryder's career that just unfortunately never happened. I think that the film, I think Winona Ryder should have been nominated for Best Actor for the film. I think she's fantastic in it. It was obviously a passion project of hers. She produced it. The article really taps into how rare it is that a piece like this, a movie like this and a piece like this would talk about mental health as frankly as it does, especially when it comes to women and the various sort of difficulties that are unfortunately engendered in the world that we live in. And I imagine being an actress is only amplified tenfold. The Winona part of this article was phenomenal. The Angelina Jolie part of this article is a little bit intolerable. It really leans into the persona that is Angelina Jolie that she ran with for quite some time until she eventually got tired of it, thankfully. This wild child thing that she felt like, I'm the hot, sexy, wild thing. Mm-hmm. Which feels like it's part of its own mental health thing, and sort of her issues with sex and sort of her sexuality, I guess, is maybe a better way of putting it. It's interesting. It's also very sort of method, you know, talks about her being Lisa on set, and all that baggage that comes with it. I don't know.
I also wonder as well, maybe because I was like, oh, it feels like they're writing about it as if it's like men doing this movie, but maybe it's because men are the only ones who ever talk about being method. So maybe in my brain I'm just like, it's weird to read about a woman doing it, because most of the time actresses are like, no, I just go home, like or like between takes I'll just be like, what's up, I think maybe that was the weird thing, is that you don't get that. And obviously Angelina always has this kind of the perception that she's like some sort of ice queen, and I guess maybe early press didn't necessarily help, like,
no, with that, for sure, kind of, you know, I she's very good in the movie. I do think she's very good. I think that Winona is better in the film, but Winona's also playing the subdued character, even if she is the protagonist.
Yeah.
Angelina Jolie, aka Lisa in the film, is so much more of the, mm-hmm. the scenery chewing crazy performance. I don't think Angelina Jolie should have won an Academy Award for the role, especially she was up against, and it's crazy, the nominations that year were crazy for Best Supporting Actress. She was up against Catherine Keener for Being John Malkovich, Samantha Morton for Sweet and Lowdown, Chloe Sevigny for Boys Don't Cry, and Toni Collette for The Sixth Sense.
Wow.
Like,
wow.
It's just, those are five. I mean, and say whatever you have to say about Sweet and Lowdown and Woody Allen, putting that out of the equation, even just the other performances. I mean, Catherine Keener is so fucking good. I mean, Toni Collette's, the scene at the end of The Sixth Sense is just unbelievable.
I just got chills, way because right? I know.
It's just, she's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, Chloe in Boys Don't Cry is just a heartbreaking, wonderful performance. Like, so I don't mean to take anything away from Angelina's performance in Girl Interrupted. She's very good in that film. And I would say that this article in its own way underlines why and how she cultivated that performance. But I think it was so much more of the, like, she's hot and cool and she played this edgy performance, and it's kind of a bummer. And I think it actually doesn't speak well to the film, but yeah, sorry, Emma.
It's also interesting as well, the fact that, like, Elizabeth Moss and Brittany Murphy, who I guess weren't as big a name, but the fact that both of them are like, no, we just went back into being us, like, between takes. Yeah. Like, yeah. They're like, why would you stay in this headspace? especially for their two characters, because their characters mm-hmm. obviously have very specific,
yep.
like, extreme things going on. So I can understand why they were like, no, I'm just gonna...
Yeah, I'm gonna go home. Yeah, I'm gonna go drink. Yeah.
Probably Elizabeth Moss probably had to do, like, classes. She probably had to go study.
It's crazy. I think it's interesting, too. I mean, I think it's my favorite James Mangold film. I like James Mangold fine. He's a solid filmmaker. I certainly don't dislike his films. I'm not sure that I'm over the moon about many of them. But I think this is, interestingly, for a film that's directed by a man that is populated almost solely by women, doesn't feel male gazy, doesn't feel gross in that way. Has a lovely sort of, genderless, feel to it, which I think is really interesting. The fact that the hospital was still running while they were filming is bonkers to me.
Yeah.
Tori's just shaking her head in disbelief. Yeah, no, it's crazy. I don't understand it.
How is that possible?
I'd love to imagine that the location scout just knocking and being like, hi.
Get on out, we gotta shoot.
They got a deal.
It's crazy. Yeah, they must have. But it's also sad that Winona Ryder's anxiety came back during the shoot because, you know, they were surrounded by people with actual mental disorders and various issues. And I imagine that only made it... I mean, I imagine it makes the film more, you know, palatable and makes it more real. And I would imagine that you feel it in the film even if you don't know it. Like, knowing it now, I do have to say to myself, like, it must have imbued the film with something intangible that I think is interesting. But I like the Susanna Kaysen bit that she came to set and saw how dedicated she was, Winona specifically, to doing it. It's a really interesting piece. Then we've got this weird thing, Wild Things, which is just a bunch, just a cobbled together bunch of photos and people that I guess they think are cool. Some of which are cool, and some of which are very much not cool. Breckin Meyer, Matthew Lillard, Tori Spelling. Don't know about those. Love the Emily Watson, Reese Witherspoon, Jeffrey Rush of it all. You know, it was Philip Seymour Hoffman's birthday a few days ago. He is still one of the actors I miss most that we lost within the last, you know, 10 years or so. It's a sad piece to read now. it's unfortunate that it's so focused on Flawless. Another Joel Schumacher joint from 99, which is a very flawed movie. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
I have seen it.
It's didn't a lot, like it. Right, Tori?
Didn't like it. Not a fan.
Here's what I love about what Tori's bringing to this episode. just hardcore truth. Very simple. I didn't like it. Just softly saying that what she does or doesn't like is fantastic. It's not a good movie. It's odd that it was made by an openly gay man and yet so oddly misinterprets drag and being gay and just all of it.
Was it badly received at the time as well?
Yes. Okay. Do you know what Flawless is about, Emma?
I have no idea. I've literally not heard of this film. I'm like,
I'll tell you very quickly that Flawless is about a man, a drag queen played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, who lives in the same building with a curmudgeonly bigoted police officer, ex-police officer played by Robert De Niro, who is injured, sorry, has a stroke, I believe, and is nursed back to health by this drag queen.
Oh, is he in drag whilst he nurses him?
Most of the time.
Okay, right.
Which is why Philip Seymour Hoffman in the article refers to all the clothes that, you know, he was wearing, the various constrictiveness of the various clothes. It's a very tone deaf movie that is very much a product of its time. I don't know that this article does Philip Seymour Hoffman justice. Would you agree?
No, yeah, especially at the end when he's like, I have to audition, read for it or something.
Ben and Gwen don't have to or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's complaining about it, which I'm like, I sort of get it. He is Philip Seymour Hoffman and he's been in a lot of things, but also like, you're not really Philip Seymour Hoffman yet. Like you're close, you're almost there. I'm sure he stopped auditioning, you know, very soon after this. My guess is he probably didn't even actually have you ever heard, and this is such a great story and I love this, about how Philip Seymour Hoffman auditioned for Almost Famous?
No.
So he refused to audition. And Cameron Crowe, as you can imagine, was very, very particular about that specific film. It was obviously very important to him, loosely based on his own life, or specifically based on his own life. And so he wouldn't give Philip Seymour Hoffman the role without at least meeting him. So he was like, will you at least please meet me? So they meet. And before they meet, he says, could I just get him to read like one scene? Like, I just need to hear the voice of Lester Bangs. Otherwise, I just don't know if I can do this. And the agent's like, he's not going to do it. Like, you can meet him and, you know, talk with him or whatever. And Cameron Crowe's like, okay, fine. So he meets with him. I think he met him at the Chateau or something like that in LA. And Philip Seymour Hoffman comes in and starts ranting about the billboards all over Sunset Boulevard. And he's just like, I can't fucking believe all this stuff. It's nonsense. Like, I think it's absurd. And he goes on this whole rant and leaves. And Cameron Crowe turns to the casting agent and says, like, I just wish that I got to hear him read. And he's like, he just did it. Like, he did it. He intentionally did this rant for you so that you could feel what his rants as Lester Bangs are going to feel like. And I just love that. I love that, like, Philip Seymour Hoffman's like, I know what you need from me, but I'm giving it to you on my own terms. I just think is such a fucking great story. Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah. But I will not read your script, but I will give you what you need. I just think that's fantastic. It just doesn't do him justice, which is sort of sad, especially more than ever. Then there's this piece on Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow, which again is just a puff piece of some, I would actually argue, better photography than most of these pieces have.
Yeah.
You know, most of them feel very kind of like whatever and kind of as you just slapdash and just put together. This at least felt like someone took the time to make sure that what could look really bad if shot poorly, that someone took the time to shoot these costumes and these sets properly. What are your thoughts on Sleepy Hollow, guys, as a movie? Have you seen it?
I loved it when it came out. And I think I've seen it since. Yeah. But not in a very long time. But no, I did love it when it was originally out. I might be a little tired of Tim Burton now, I guess, and also drunk up. So.
I think I also saw this in school.
Oh, well, sure, because it's a historical fiction.
I think it was like one of those times where like they just like put a movie on to like, do something.
I mean, I guess it's old-timey, and they're like, I guess this is history.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'll say this. Both of these films are about New York and historic history from New York, so perhaps there's something there. I mean, I obviously love Sleepy Hollow, but I do look forward to us covering it at some point on the podcast. I remember being just absolutely over the moon excited for it. I was, and to a lesser degree, still am a Tim Burton fan. I look forward to him someday giving us another great movie, if he can. I hope he can. Tori's face speaking volumes. I don't disagree with you.
Not a huge fan.
I can't articulate how sort of like in my DNA he is as a filmmaker, and some of those films are just so fundamental to my writing and to the things that I do that it's hard for me not to be like, fucking love the guy. But I'm also just like, the guy is pretty ridiculous now. I'm also deeply resentful that he's dating Eva Green right now. That
is he? I did not know that. Wow.
Oh.
Huh.
It seems as though there's a pattern for him dating women that co-stars of his. I don't know. That's a big age difference between them, I can only assume. Yes. So I remember being very excited. I remember that there were, you know, seeing the stills from it. It was just such a beautifully made film. It's understandable why it won Best Production Design. I think it should have won Best Costumes as well. Like, I would argue it might be his best production, like in terms of the attention to detail and the specificity of what he was trying to do. The fact that also, it's crazy, but like I think it's like 80-85% of that film is interiors. So there are horses just running around forced perspective sound stages. Like, it's just bonkers to think about how it was made. Obviously there are shots of like when it's the town square and stuff like that, like those are obviously exteriors, but so much of it is interior. And so much of it is just like playing with perspective and playing with lenses in order to make it seem big. It's just really, really special stuff. And I think that this piece, or at least these photos, give a little bit of a sense of that, which was nice back then. So our last issue is November. On the cover of it, we have Kate Winslet in a pretty heinous outfit, as we mentioned earlier. I want to talk about, there's a couple articles that need to be talked about. The first is this Shy But Barely.
Can I read the pull quote? It's so bad. Right, okay. So it's actually, it's not so much being nude in the movies that's the problem. It's being nude in all those producers' offices. At least when you're shooting the film, there's a guaranteed paycheck and witnesses. Which is truly the most chilling thing that you could possibly... And I don't know when they pulled that quote, if they're like, this is one of the worst fucking things I've read, or whether like, this is titillating. It's an odd... Yeah.
I really don't fully understand what the thesis of this piece is.
No.
It's so all over the place.
It's written by a woman, I believe.
Yeah.
So it's written by a woman. Yeah. And it feels like what she's saying is actresses are fucking stupid for getting naked.
Well, no, she's the one who's... is getting naked.
She's an actress, right?
Yeah. So she does a lot.
Because that was sort of lost on me in the sense that she was, let me put it this way. I gleaned that she was or used to be an actress, but there's an anger towards successful actors or actresses.
Yes. Yeah.
And because of that, there's like this axe being grinded throughout it. Of like, why am I not famous? I did all this terrible stuff too. And you're like,
no. Yeah, she's mad at like, I think, yeah, she's Gwyneth as an example of being like, when an actor says they're a shy person, they're like, bullshit.
It's bullshit.
Yeah.
But like, is that valid. Like, I mean, you can be a shy person and also, you know, be nude in a film. Like, I don't know.
It's just, it's
definitely working through some stuff.
The nude auditions as well, which I actually didn't realize were a thing until the Noel Clark stuff came out. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't realize that.
Which is those fucking insane.
I enjoyed that she named Don Simpson. That was fun. Uh-huh. As being a pervert, which obviously.
Not a surprise.
And the fact that she talks about also they're not being closed sets when she's doing nudity and that everyone comes along to it's very strange and disturbing.
It's very strange. It's very disturbing. It's definitely a time capsule of a moment. And thankfully, I think that a lot of this behavior has been curtailed. I think that, you know, especially now we have people that are for sex scenes in particular that are there to make sure that people that aren't, no lines are being crossed, and that people are comfortable and any number of things. This article was just upsetting, but it was also just muddled by her anger and resentment that I felt like she lost the thread.
Yeah, there's no thesis at all. Like, it's she's kind of mad at everyone.
Like, mad at the wrong people. I don't know. It was weird.
Her book was called "If I'm So Famous, How Come Nobody's Ever Heard of Me?" So I guess
it's ironic.
Yeah.
Unintentionally so, because I've never heard of her or her book. So I don't know what to make of any of it. The next article is an article on home entertainment / digital filmmaking, which I actually really loved, because there's a couple things in it that were just kind of fascinating to me that I wanted to unpack with you guys. The first was... The article really taps into digital filmmaking in 99, right? This from a technological perspective. It gets too technical for its own good at times, but you understand that A, things looked like crap back then when it was shot digitally. For the most part, it just did, right? But independent filmmakers embraced it because it was cost-effective, it was accessible, and it was an opportunity to make a fucking movie, right? So you were just like, I don't give a shit. And Dogma 95 comes out of that. You know what the Dogma 95 stuff is, guys?
I know.
I'll explain it just for our listeners and for you guys as well a little bit. Dogma 95 is the whole Lars von Trier thing. Lars von Trier, Thomas Vinterberg, both kind of are part of this idea of, and they called it the Dogma 95, where there were certain rules that your film had to go by. You couldn't shoot on film. You couldn't have a murder. You couldn't have various things that were, you know, tropes of Hollywood films. So it forced you into a box and it created a whole group of films, some of which are really interesting. The Celebration being a big one, obviously, Dancer in the Dark and a lot of Lars von Trier's films. It embraced this ability to make a film on the cheap and dirty and just really kind of embrace the technology that was in front of them. And we've seen that evolve since then, obviously, into any number of independent films and the fact that now digital and film is almost indistinguishable in a lot of ways. So, you know, we are where we are. But I just thought it was really interesting to sort of see this moment of how exciting it must have been. I mean, again, I'm starting film school in 1999, so I'm feeling a little bit of this, but I'm not. But I'm still looking at these films, and they looked so bad, and it was so hard to kind of really, you know, engage with them with their, you know, their blown out colors, their, you know, spotty, grimy, blotchy visuals. Like, it was just all very hard to watch. Mm-hmm. Then there's a section on TiVo, which is starting. TiVo is becoming a thing, which I think is adorable, the way they talk about it as like this little moment. But it's the TiVo and the sightsound.com intersection that I think is really interesting, right? There's this moment where there's this company, which is Netflix before Netflix, basically, which I'd never heard of before in my life. It's called sightsound.com, where you paid to rent these digital films. And I kind of want to be like, if I'm sightsound.com, I got to be like, is there a lawsuit to be formed? Is there something that I can, because like, it's crazy. But then you've got the intersection of the, of these two things in this article of TiVo, which is the beginning of DVRs, the beginning of people being able to record things and fast forward through commercials and not have to be home to watch things. So everything kind of changes off of that, as you guys very well know. And then folded in with this sightsound.com thing where you're seeing essentially streaming is happening before it's really happening is just kind of fascinating to me that like tucked into this weird little article in Premiere Magazine in October of 1999 are the tea leaves of the future and where we are right now. It's just kind of fascinating.
Yeah. I also think the prices of DVD players are very expensive.
Insane.
Yeah, no wonder. No wonder like in Fast and Furious, they're like stealing DVD players. Yeah. There's one here that's like $3,000.
Yeah, it's
like,
crazy. It's crazy.
What?
Yeah. Imagine. The whole entertainment system back then. I mean, when you think about it now, first of all, finding a DVD or a Blu-ray player is hard enough. Like you can barely find them.
I still use mine quite a lot.
I do too. I mean, my Criterion collection gets a lot of use and I still love Blu-rays. But it is fascinating that back in the day, these home entertainment systems were so expensive. And now, I mean, this comes back in a weird way full circle to the James Cameron thing up top, right? Which is, he talks about the theatrical experience being impenetrable. Mm-hmm. And I just sadly don't think that's the case anymore, right? I mean, you can get a 60, 70 inch flat screen television in 4K for a pretty reasonable price. You can get streaming content in 1080p. I mean, like, or 4K, like, it's home entertainment systems are just pretty reasonably priced now and pretty reasonable in that respect. And I, it's kind of crazy to see that and to see how crazy expensive these DVD players were back then. Then at the end of the article, we have a really lovely bit with Thelma Schoonmaker where she talks about digital editing. And this is sort of sprinkled in through a bunch of articles in a bunch of these issues. But like, that's the next frontier that we're really sensing coming out of 99 and going into the early 2000s, which is digital editing, right? Which is scanning the film essentially into Avid or various programs, what have you. Thelma pretty quick on the uptake on this, even if she's reluctant to do so at the time. She added a Casino in 95 digitally, which I didn't know, which is interesting. And Scorsese hates it. He's just annoyed by it, doesn't understand it, can't follow where she is. I think it's fantastic. I love, because I mean, she's obviously notoriously, she's the only editor he's ever used, essentially. He's the only filmmaker she edits, which I love. And just there's all these old pictures of them in the editing room behind these old moviolas and just imagining sort of the progression of things to him just now cross-armed behind a computer, just angry and huffing like an old man. It's just fantastic. And then you've got Ebert complaining about digital distribution and just, you know, like an old man with his fist towards the sky, frustrated with a technology that's inevitable and that we're obviously living with now, which is, you know, digital is the future. And I'm not suggesting that I'm against celluloid. I think people should still use it. I think IMAX is great, but like you also have to embrace where things are headed as well. Two last articles to wrap up. The first is a infuriating article written by William Goldman, which is an excerpt from some book he wrote.
He's so angry.
So many angry people.
Yeah.
It's a lot of angry old guys.
Yeah, old white guys. The gray 90s. And I guess it's an excerpt from this book he wrote. And he basically talks about how the 90s were a shit decade and that no good movies came out in 99. It's infuriating. He sort of like flippantly, offhandedly mentions like five movies, three of which I wouldn't even include in like great 90s films. I don't think Four Weddings and a Funeral is a great 90s
No.
film. I don't, and there was, what were the others? Forgive me, I don't have it in front of me.
Lethal Weapon 3. This is René Russo one. Sorry, that's
it's at the beginning of the article.
He loves René Russo.
He does love René Russo.
Russo, God, not Russo. What am I talking about? My bad. Anyway, Where is this?
It's at the very beginning. He lists like a ham. It's not like a. It's not like a list. It's like in the first.
Here we go. Sorry, yeah. Shawshank Redemption, sure. Unforgiven, Babe, Hoop Dreams. Which one's from Fargo? What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
That's the other
Funeral and Groundhog Day.
Yeah. What's Eating Gilbert Grape, which is now just straight up problematic, having Leonardo DiCaprio play a mentally challenged or you know, a person with a mental disorder. There's that. Then second, Four Weddings and a Funeral, which is way worse than Notting Hill, just FYI.
Way worse?
Way worse. That's a ridiculous list. I could give you a list of 50 to 100 great films that were made in the 90s, like Stone Cold classics. Here's what screams to me from this article, which is that all art evolves very quickly, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that, and people get left behind and people get angry and they sound frustrated when they are left behind. I love William Goldman. He's written some of the greatest screenplays ever written. I think The Princess Bride and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid are unimpeachably perfect movies. But like, you got to evolve, right? And you've got to be able to see how this art form is evolving. And don't tell me that there weren't shitty films made in the 50s, 60s, and 70s too. Like, it's just crazy.
Yeah, it's a very narrow, like, view. And yeah, he's the one who totally bashes Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, Uncut Gems, all right? Just wait a few years.
Yeah, William's not with us anymore. He didn't see Uncut Gems, but yes. But
Punch Drunk Club? Did he see that?
He did see that. He should have seen that. Yeah. I also just think that there's a little bit of a purity as well to the way people look backwards. There's a lot of rose-colored glasses. I mean, I've been watching these AFI films for this AFI club that I have with friends over the course of the pandemic. And, you know, they're classics. I get why they're classics, but like, some of them are just like not that great anymore. And like, don't get me started, but like, I don't think Citizen Kane is the greatest film ever made.
Even something like MASH, which I don't even know if he mentions. Like, I watched MASH and I was like, what the fuck is this? It's so offensive.
I watched MASH. That was one of our first films that we watched, which is on the AFI 100. And that movie fucking sucks.
It does. I wonder if maybe, because the TV show obviously won't be as like, offensive. But yeah, no, I was just like, what the fuck is this? So yeah, like, yeah,
it's also crazy where you're like, he's also putting too much stock in the Academy Award nominations as well. Mm-hmm. Like picking these, you know, what the five best picture nominees are as though that makes a year unimpeachable is also just like, come on, man.
But then he doesn't do the same for the 90s. It's like he picks these five movies from the 70s and it's like, where are the 90s equivalent? Like,
it's really crazy.
It's very old man yells at cloud.
It's get off my lawn.
It's a lot of that. And then so our last article is the Kate Winslet article, which I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I kind of hate when articles do shticky stuff like the pretending it's a screenplay thing.
Yeah. It made it hard to read. I was like, I'm not reading this, but like skim.
I skimmed the script parts of it.
I'll
read the rest of it. I think it's really interesting. Kate Winslet's career is a fascinating one. It continues to be. But I think like post-Titanic, there's a little bit of the like, Hollywood doesn't quite know what to do with her, because I think she, and it's fucking absurd to say it, but that she doesn't meet the aesthetic of what they think a movie star is, which is stupid. Mm-hmm. They keep calling her voluptuous and all these various sort of like coded bullshit things.
Yeah.
You know, you've got people calling her agent, asking her how her weight is, like just stuff that's fucked and gross. So Hollywood doesn't know what to do with that. And then there's also, I can only assume, both Leo and Kate both went through the what do I do next sort of, you know, the wilderness of what that looks like. And I respect her choices, you know, working with Jane Campion, you know, making the films that she made at the time, I think are really interesting. As we mentioned, she turns down Shakespeare in Love. She turns down Anna and the King, which was probably for the best. She's kind of in this weird space. And I kind of feel like it's Eternal Sunshine that's the course correction. I don't want to say course correction, but it's when things start to get a little bit back on rails and start to feel like people are like, oh, wait a second. She's obviously unbelievable in that film. Spoiler, she should have won Best Actress for that role. She's unbelievable in it. And it's also when people are like, oh, she can do American, which is part of, I think, the whole stupid American nonsense. But that's when things start to kind of shift. The article did make me want to watch Quills again, though. So I don't know. I mean... What did you guys think of the article? What did you think about it? I forgot she was married to that guy.
Yeah, just going to say that. When she was 15, she was living with someone who was 27?
Yeah.
I don't have anything good to say about it.
And it didn't really... They didn't, like, frame it like it was a bad thing either. And I was like,
They're like, it's fine. It's okay.
Okay. Sure.
But yeah. I will say the picture of them, they look kind of adorable. Like, the two of them look very... And I don't mean... I'm saying that, like... She's right. Obviously... How old is she when she actually gets married to him? I think she's 20?
Sure.
It's not the same guy. She doesn't marry the same guy.
No, this is... The one who, like, died.
That's a different thing.
Yeah.
I'm speaking of the guy she married.
Oh, I was thinking about the guy who...
No, she
was 15, which is...
No, I was not saying they're adorable. I was saying the picture of her and her husband at the bottom.
Oh, yes.
They look very cute. I just forgot, A, that he even existed, that she was even married to this guy. Like, I didn't even know it was a thing. Like, Sam Mendes is the first person that I, in my brain, think she was married to. It's just interesting. She just sort of... There's this interesting part in her life of, like, post-Titanic, pre sort of Eternal Sunshine, where I feel like... Hollywood and her are just not really in simpatico. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
Well, it feels though, like, reading this interview and reading interviews with her now, she sounds like the same person. Like, that's the thing. You kind of get this, like that's, it's very much, like, she's, like, I don't give a shit what people say about my weight. Right. Like, it's bullshit. Like, you kind of get this, like, thread of, like, I don't want to say authenticity because it always sounds so wanky, but, like, it does, like, sound...
It does seem authentic, yeah.
Yeah. I like the Manly Linsky stuff. That's cool. Because Heavenly Creatures is great and disturbing, and the fact that's good. How they describe it, like...
Her and Kate Blanchett have similar kind of... They come across similarly, or like similar headspaces of, like...
Yeah.
And it's interesting. You talk to some actors that do the movie for the role, right? Where they're just like, I really like my role. I really like what I'm going to be doing. And they're not really looking at sort of the macro of the entire project, right? Mm-hmm. And those tend to be the filmographies where you're like, well, they're always good, right? Because they're always good. Like, Cate Blanchett's great in Pushing 10. That movie's a fucking crazy mess of a movie, but she's great in it. And the same can be said about Kate Winslet. And I do think that there's that authenticity, that groundedness, that, dare I say, that Britishness. I know that Kate Winslet's Australian, but still, like, there's that sort of the distance.
Kate Winslet's not.
Sorry.
Oh, do you mean Kate Blanchett? Kate Blanchett. I was going to say, yeah, right. I was like,
you were like, no, no, no.
No,
Kate Winslet's ours.
Weekly.
Yeah.
but I think that there's that sort of distance from Hollywood that gives them a little bit of groundedness and allows them to sort of be able to focus on the bigger picture. And I mean, Kate Winslet in interviews recently, even during the pandemic, she just seems like the fucking best. Like, I want to have a beer with Kate Winslet. She just seems so cool and lovely and understands how sort of lucky she is to get to do what she does, which is something that is not only incredibly rare in these issues of these magazines that we've covered, but also very rare in this town and in this industry. So it was a lovely way to end all of this. I'll speak very briefly of the final issue, which in December of 99 had everyone's favorite Johnny Depp on the cover. It was a holiday movie special. Movies that changed America, from Shampoo to Saving Private Ryan. Interesting.
Shampoo changed America.
I know. I was surprised too, Tori. there is a piece on The Breakfast Club. I guess there's some pieces on Lisa Kudrow, Denzel Washington, Charlize Theron, Chow Yun-Fat, Tobey Maguire. And then there is a bit on The Insider, which I would have liked to have read. That movie's obviously a masterpiece. But yeah, I mean, overall, I feel as though like this was not just obviously fun talking with you guys about it, but like it was a really kind of fun roller coaster through the industry at the time, and really gave me a whole new perspective on a bunch of stuff that I wouldn't have thought of otherwise. But I guess the thing that to end this, I kind of want to ask you both individually what you think sort of the biggest thing that you're left with from all of this. Like, what was the thing that kind of hit you the hardest over the course of all these issues? Like, I'll do mine first and you guys can take a second to think about that. But I mean, the biggest thing for me ultimately is unfortunately the gender sort of discrepancy. That's sort of the biggest thing. And you guys might very well say the same as the biggest thing that hit you, but that's kind of the thing that I'm just like, I really hope that we've made some actual lasting fucking progress. Like this industry is so two steps forward, one step back. My hope is that we've made real change and that we have made real, you know, systemic change in more female filmmakers, more, you know, obviously people of color, just making sure that more voices are getting heard. But that was the thing that hit me the most, that like the way women were treated through these articles was pretty deplorable, pretty despicable.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my thing, it's just how messy, I mean, it's still messy now, but just how messy the reporting talks about the messiness, whereas everything feels like there's the PR sheen now. Like, I think maybe, yeah, because of social media, like, you can't have these kind of slightly more, like, spontaneous, and maybe it's not actually a bad thing that you can't, you know, do a hatchet job on someone. But, and that's the weird thing. So I was like, yes, there's loads of like female writers doing these profiles, but half of them are like a little bit contemptuous towards their subject. Yeah. So it's that weird thing of like women being against women. And like, obviously you can't be for someone just because they're the same gender as you, but you also don't want them painting you like a bimbo. Like, even if you are. Like,
yeah. I guess that's the other big thing that I took away from it was how bold these pieces are. Like the idea of them just being like, there's just no sheen, there's no artifice. It's just like,
yeah,
just out there. It's pretty crazy. Very different. What about you, Tori?
One, a lot of cigarette ads.
Yes,
of cigarette ads. So many cigarette ads,
and they're like, they have the Surgeon General warning, so it's like, buy your cigarettes, but you will die. that was my number one thing. And the other, just like, yeah, the women, there's like a lot of, this kind of carries over from the Rolling Stone as well, where it's like a lot of weird comments about women's bodies. Like the way they describe women is very weird. And hopefully that is not as common now. But
yeah,
that was basically what you said. A lot of weird stuff about women that hopefully is.
I'm so glad you mentioned the advertisements, because I do want to just talk about that very briefly, and then I'll let you guys go because I know we've been talking for a very long time. But I'll just say, lots of jeans, like ads for weird jeans with like ladies' jeans with like celebrities, you know, like Alyssa Milano in a pair of like crazy ass jeans.
I didn't
in
front have of, like, any of those.
And like some, I can show you. Hold on, because there's so many of them. Yes,
lots of booze
pops out.
There's
this,
like,
ridiculous. This is a cigarette ad.
Yeah, it's
what nuts. Brand is that?
What, here's
Marlboro.
Oh, okay.
Here's Maya for Bongo.
Bongo.
And then there was another one. Bear with me for one second here as I find it. It's also a different time when like you had stuff like this, where you'd have like a big old advertisement for Titanic being on DVD, which I just absolutely love. And then, here it is. Here's Alyssa Milano for introducing Candy's jeans.
Oh my God, Candy's.
Wow.
That's a flashback.
That's a look. Oh,
it's
wow.
Just, it's crazy. And then I posted a thing on Twitter of this like really weird DVD
you like buy them from each category?
Yeah, we had to buy from each category, but it was all like a Chinese food restaurant menu. And I was just like, what are you doing? Who thought this was a good idea? It's just, it's really crazy stuff. Yeah, the ads, I agree with you, are, it's just also amazing. It was a different time where you had like, you had stuff like this. Do you guys remember these? Where it was like, you know, Suncoast, and you were like, you could buy DVDs. Or, but like, it's also just, it's a different time when the sell-through market, which is what they used to call, like when you bought VHS, when it was available to the public, because most of the time it was rental, right? You had to rent stuff for many, many months until you could actually buy it on video cassette yourself. So what do you got? So it's a lot of like that.
I was going to say, there's Premier merch. I want some merch. There
you
go.
I actually do want some of that merch. It's not, you know, there's a bunch of it in a box somewhere for sure. There's no way they sold all that shit. There's just, hold on. There was one other one that I wanted to.
There's lots of alcohol, lots of booze.
Here's what Tori is talking about in terms of just gigantic cigarette ads for
this cannabis. Is another one. What is this? It's like a chili.
I have a sex ad video.
For Salem? I don't know what this is.
What about this?
So crazy.
You can, sex education for me.
I mean, this is also, I mean, I'm sure you guys remember this, but this was, these were huge.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember that.
I mean, just the simplicity of these ads. But there was just like, hold on. There's a lot of cars. It's
the Golden Globes.
Of like,
by the way, this is what I want. This is literally.
That's the fucking best. That is fantastic. That really takes me back.
The iMac to go in orange. Like,
it's really it's a lot of advertisements for cars, for DVDs, for beverages.
I feel like I need to see this movie. I've never heard of this.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Literally doing it on the podcast tomorrow.
Oh my God, that I need to watch. I'm going to watch it.
It's on Paramount Plus if you have Paramount Plus.
I do. I'm going to watch it.
So, and then I just want to make sure that I'm not forgetting any other ads that I wanted to talk to you guys about.
Just magnificent. Some old, nice old cell phones. And I thought,
did you have that phone?
No, I didn't like anything that was like slidey or flippy. I had the 32 and the 33 10. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed just the brick.
Slidey or flippy, she says.
Yeah, no, slidey or flippy.
Did you guys find that there was a lot of like Kahlua ads?
No. Maybe it's seasonal. They probably have ones for different seasons. I have cranberry and Southern Comfort because that's the combination I want to drink.
So they also have this thing at the back, which is like a classifieds for like film schools and stuff, which I'm like, which I found kind of strange. Like you could, like there's an MBA in media management that you could get at the Aubrey. Wow. Like just very strange stuff. Guys, Winston? It was a different time. It was amazing. I loved it. I loved doing this. I now own a bunch of Premier magazines again, which is amazing.
I'm gonna add mine to my
add to your collection. The question now is, what magazine should we cover next, guys? Because I feel like we do need to cover another magazine. Do you guys have thoughts? I wanted to brainstorm with you.
Have you done Vanity Fair?
We did. We only did. The short answer is no. What we did was a weird one-off episode. It's long story short, all we covered was the cover of the Young Hollywood 1999 issue. So I'd be 100% down to do Vanity Fair. Count me in.
All of theirs are online. All of as long as you're if you're a subscriber, like subscriber, either so that literally everything is there. I've got I think 5 of the print ones, but
and that's there's only they do that monthly, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then I think Vanity Fair would be a good one.
Some fun ones and some weird ones, but yeah.
I'm okay.
Vanity Fair is always great.
It's gonna be, that's going to be fantastic. Can't wait to do it, and it's online, so we don't have to deal with eBay losing.
And the writers that definitely hate their subject. Kate Hudson one is 2000 though, unfortunately. But you should read it because there's so much contempt. It's so weird. It's like poor Kate Hudson.
I think we should absolutely do Vanity Fair, and maybe even be able to get a guest from Vanity Fair. I feel like might be some ways for us to get somebody to come on and talk about it with us for a little bit too. So, but Vanity Fair's next. Can't wait to do that with you guys. That's gonna be a lot of fun. We'll do that down the road a little bit, but it'll be fun to cover that. And also, when I get my hands on this Selma Hayek issue of Premiere someday, we'll do a one-off of just that issue. So we can, close the loop on that. But thank you so much for doing this, guys. I can't believe we talked for three hours about Premiere Magazine. This has been tremendous. You're both awesome, and I can't wait to talk with you guys soon.
Awesome. Bye. Podcast like it. You want to